you're listening to a Talk of Spirit Anime Cast. My name is Andrew. I'm joined here with Chris.
Yo.
Today's episode is our fall 2021 anime season reviews part two. We have a crap load of tiles to go through, including Komi-san Can't Communicate, The Aquatope on White Sand, My Senpai is Annoying, The Faraway Paladin, Banished from the Hero's Party. I decided to start a quiet life in a small town. I didn't write the whole title down there. Sakugan, Taisho Tomi Fairy Tale, Selection Project, The Way of the House Husband Part 2, Irina the Vampire Cosmonaut, Rumble Garandal, Kaginato, Can I Make Your Ears Happy in 180 Seconds? That's not a question, that's just a title. And 86 Part 2, or second season, depending on where you look it up, because that's not ending anytime soon, so I figured we review it. we might as well call that a wrap for the season, because it's going to be a while before we get around to it again, but it is what it is, unfortunately. But yeah, a lot to go through. Are you excited? Did you finish Aquatope?
Yes.
You did. Did you finish Komi-san?
Yes.
Did you finish Faraway Paladin?
Yes.
Did you finish Garandal?
No.
Just thought I'd throw another one in there for the heck of it. Yes, I'm happy because as of today, I have recorded all of my video reviews, so I'm officially done with fall. Now, granted, we still got to do our deliberations, so that'll be a whole nother fun fiasco next week, but I'll be doing preparations for that this week. I might do a live stream to kind of talk to people while I do that setup.
I thought about that too. I was wondering if I didn't want to mention it on the.
I'm mixed because it's like, do I want that distraction of the live stream when I'm trying to put all that stuff? Because it technically makes it take longer, but it's more fun because you can talk to people at the same time. So. Yeah. I'm really up in the air if I'll do it or not, but I think it'd be fun if I do. But either way, we'll see. But yeah, with that said, we have a lot to go through and not too much time because we're actually recording at a different time than we normally do because Chris had to work. So Chris is tired. Hopefully I can get his energy up.
Got a couple of fun shows, so hopefully maybe.
All right, let's kick things off. We have Komi Can't Communicate or Komi-san wa Komi-yoshu desu. This one streamed on Funimation, ran for 12 episodes. Done by Studio OLM, source is a manga, and the genres are comedy, romance, slice of life. And the series composition was done by Hitomi Mueno, who, of course, has done a lot of really fantastic titles, so solid series composition writer with it. But yeah, this one follows a guy named Tadano. He is going to a new school. As you kind of find out through some narration, that the school's kind of different in the idea that it has apparently the school's kind of different in that it has a very long kind of interview process to find out who would be in the school itself, and that means that everybody's kind of weird in some way, as you quickly find out when you see the other cast members. But yeah, he seems to be normal, but it seems to note the idea that he's very observant of things, and we kind of find that out, especially later on, as he falls asleep and sleeps into the PE scheduled class, and this girl, Komi, who's like extremely popular in the school, stays behind to kind of tell him that they have PE. And when he wakes up, she doesn't really say anything to him and quickly leaves after writing down exactly what is going on. And he's like, you know, hey, do you have a problem with communication? And sure enough, he starts writing on the chalkboard and she starts replying through the chalkboard. And eventually he comes to find out that, yeah, she apparently has a problem with talking to people. Now, the thing that kind of spirals out of control from that point is now that she's talking to him through this chalkboard, she starts going crazy. And she starts writing
unloading
a whole bunch of stuff. So it quickly indicates, and sadly it's kind of missed in the Netflix translation, is that she's talking about not just that, you know, she wants to talk. She's also talking about everything that she's wanted to talk about for like the last, you know, this entire school year so far. I mean, it's not that far into it, but like everybody's conversation they're having, she wanted to get involved. There's these insecurities she's had. She's just unloading everything, not just the current. And so you get a quick idea that she's got this insecurity and she's always had it. But more than everything, she wants to fix it. And not only that, but she wants 100 friends because I don't know why. I really have to look into this. I got to figure out what the 100 friend thing is because, again, everything has it. Hitoi Bochi, this season has one, which is the Sailor Uniform show. They all as 100. I don't know what that is about that. But anyways, he's like, sure, I'll help you. And I'll be your first one, which is obviously embarrassing because protagonist character is embarrassed by that. But thus begins this whole adventure of getting her 100 friends. And so, again, like I mentioned before, it basically involves them communicating to people in the class that are weird. everybody has their super quirk, and so it makes it a little difficult, but yeah, that's their goal, is to make 100 friends and at the same time help her get more comfortable with communicating, which I'd argue really didn't really get very far with this season, that's for sure, but that's the whole shtick, so why not? So I'm going to let you go first because I don't really want to talk about this show for the most part. I struggled recording my video review.
This one I absolutely adored. This one for me, it absolutely scratched that almost a similar itch that Hitori Bochi did, where Hitori Bochi is more of a cutesy version of the almost the same thing. This one is more in the comedy area, a lot of sketch comedy type things where they you have pretty much two just wildly absurd different personalities, and how they kind of come to find some kind of an agreement where they can effectively become friends. And this is really kind of the drive through most of this entire show. Some characters are a lot more fun than others, but I definitely had a lot of fun with the show. Each one of them bringing their own little flavor to the cast, and then just having a lot of fun.
Yeah, I agree. Cool. No, I had told most people in my review, which I'll probably have that posted before this review thing goes live, but my difficulty that I have with this show, it's obviously the fact this is one of those shows where I feel like I'm the outside looking in, because it's doing well, its ratings are good. It had a lot of viewership on Miami List specifically. I think this one overtook most all the other shows in the season. And so there's a lot of popularity behind this, and I know that a lot of that has to do with a very large fandom for the manga before it even came out. And I don't want to say that I made that hype for the manga being adapted, you know, cloud my judgment, because I didn't go into it going, okay, let's see what's so great about this. And I even loved the first episode. I mean, my first impressions, I was praising this show. I'm like, this is a fantastic opening. Like, the chalkboard scene, despite Netflix's issues, was a phenomenal scene. It was just well done, well directed, great shots. You felt that frustration in Komi. And Komi was a cute character. Even though I don't like her normal appearance, where it's like this triangle hair and this overly squinty eyes that nobody else in the cast seemed to have. She just doesn't look like she fits art style wise in this cast, which is obviously why she's popular and attractive to everybody. But my attraction to her obviously was that whole aspect of her being like timid and struggling with things. But at the same time, it's like only so many times I could see that before that gets old as well. But it was just really my issue came as it went along. I liked the childhood friend. That was just, I've never seen that before. This idea of this person is everybody's childhood friend. It was funny. I like the whole, the festival where the childhood friend guy walks up and suddenly out of nowhere, this huge crowd of like 100 people are behind them. Are like, oh yeah, that's all my friends. They're all wanting to come too. And it's like, holy crap, this person has it. It was funny. The fact that also that childhood friend, everybody but Komi.
Yeah.
And he tried a long time ago. It just didn't work out because Komi can't communicate. But, then beyond that, after they kind of brought in the childhood friend character, it was just downhill from there. Like, every character they introduced was like, oh, there's the Yandere character. Don't know why she's not in jail. Oh, there's the I want to be treated like a dog character. Okay, cool. Oh, there's the Chunibyo. There's the country bumpkin. There's the overly, you know, competitive character. It hit every single one of the, they even had the Ditzy character. They had every single one of the archetypes introduced, and it's like, okay, cool, we got that character in the cast now. And then it would turn into, okay, now let's go here, and let's bring this batch of those characters in, let them play their same tropes, and then we'll go to this location, and then we'll bring in this cast of characters, and they'll do their tropes, their one-note tropes. And it never seemed like it did anything beyond that. And it was just really frustrating, and I couldn't get into it. And I was, unfortunately, extremely bored throughout the entire show because I wasn't getting laughs out of any of that stuff. And it is one of those things where I'm kind of struggling. I do want to look into what people found so enjoyable about it, because I'm trying to figure out where I missed it. Like, why am I wrong? Why am I broken, Chris? But I never really found anything besides people really like Komi. And it's like, okay, well, that's cool. But what about anything else? The rest of the show that I wasn't getting, I don't get it. I don't get what these tropes are so funny when they're the same joke, just in a different setting. So that was my frustration that I had. And like I said, I was looking for it. And I think I heard somewhere where it shifts at some point. So I don't know if the shift already happened and I just didn't catch it. But I was also kind of watching along, hoping that they would have that point. Like, my expectation was that after they would introduce everybody, it would maybe get more romantic or something. Maybe there's a shift there. I don't know if maybe that's something in the second season, because they've already announced a second season. But
yeah, it did feel like they the main two. It's obvious that it's there, but it wasn't overt yet. So yeah.
they are trying to really push the two of them, but I unfortunately, again, I didn't really feel like any of it advanced in any way. It was just still I do think that they were putting more emphasis later on Comey really trying to force herself to say something, but of course she never did because she can't communicate. That's her whole shtick. But yeah, it's unfortunate. I tried really hard, and I apologize to everybody. Not every show is going to be for everybody. I'm not going to sit here and bash it and say it's a terrible show. I know that there's going to be plenty of people that's going to enjoy it. I'm apparently the outlier, so I don't know. Hopefully somebody out there is like, yeah, Andrew, don't worry. I'm with you. I didn't get it either. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I did like a lot of the cast. I mean, each member. I mean, yes, I really adore Comey, but I'm not going to say that my entire enjoyment, well, yeah, a lot of my enjoyment is around Comey, but
exactly. I think that's it. And it's like, I'm not being mean here. It's like, I wonder, like, how do people ignore how 80% of the show isn't Comey and yet they still love it? That doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, I almost would disagree. I mean, It generally all revolves around how is she reacting to each situation.
What difference in every scene is her reaction? It's the same reaction every time.
Yeah, no, I won't disagree with that. I mean, a lot of her cutesy, you know, not really. I mean,
it begs the question of like how much can a waifu carry a show? Like, despite everything that I am pointing out personally. Can it still be carried is a crazy question that I have, I guess.
I'm guessing so, because I enjoyed it. I mean, I like I said, I like a lot of the other characters. The only one that I didn't much care was probably the airhead that they introduced in the latter episodes. But I didn't hate her. She was in a
trash can. How cute is that? She just found herself comfortable in a trash can.
I've never... The flighty character has always been one that's kind of been a mix for me. Unless they really pull off I guess it really comes down to if they can ata-ata well, really what it comes down to.
Yes, it's typically that.
Yeah, because that's usually
I did honestly get a couple laughs out of that. So that is another funny thing, is that's like one of the few characters I got a laugh out of. And it was more of the idea of like Comey going to like struggle to tell her something. And then she goes to write it down. And then she looks up and the girl's gone. And she's like, I don't know, has a chainsaw in her hand there. But and she's like, I don't know, what is this thing? It's like, okay, that was funny. I got a little chuckle.
But I mean, like I said, I didn't hate her. It just, she was probably the character that I disliked. I mean, I didn't like the most.
No, worst case. No. So you're going to say that's the worst character to you.
The worst character
You're gonna disagree with me that Makaru was the worst character in the show.
Which one?
She was the over-competitive one.
Didn't bother me.
Really? She was so annoying. Like, out of all the tropes, archetype trope characters, that was the most annoying. Because it was literally the jokes were... It never changed. Okay, this. Competing. I lost still. Competing. I lost still. Competing. Lost still.
Anyway. No, the flighty character was probably my least favorite. The closest one that you could probably come to is maybe...
They did nothing with the Chuni character. Holy crap. She disappeared until like the end, and then suddenly she invited Comey to her house. And I'm like, oh yeah, there's that character.
I wanted more out of the Chuni character, I'll admit. But they didn't do much with her. I mean, the only other one that I would kind of agree with you, and I don't go as far as Andrew, is the quote-unquote Yandere character.
You won't go with me on, or does frustrate you?
Doesn't frustrate me near as bad as you did.
Oh. It was shrug. At that point, I was numb to it.
Yeah. I mean,
I just was the entire time going, why is this girl not in jail? Because she literally was going to kill him. Like, this isn't like your typical Yandere. She was literally going to kill him.
It was one of those things where you see the joke, you go, okay, I got your joke. You don't have to carry it out for 2.5 episodes, got the joke. Okay.
Well, that was my feeling when they introduced the family members. It was like, immediately the mom opens the door and she's super eccentric. And I'm like, yeah, I kind of see that coming. I knew that she was going to have so many relatives that wasn't that way. And the father's super quiet. I'm like, okay, here's the joke. We get it. Everybody's going to be either super loud or super quiet. And then it proceeds to show you like 5 family members and it keeps going back and forth. I'm like, I get the joke. I get it. You don't have to show everybody. And suddenly I'm waiting for them to pick up the phone and call up like their late relatives and then show all them answering the phone in different ways. It's like, I get the joke. Just let it go. Anyways. I'm going back into it. But yeah, there's Comey Song, Can't Communicate. I'm going to run away from this whole conversation. Watch it. I'm the minority. Don't worry about my criticisms. Comedy subjective. There you go. I'll hide behind that one. Anyways, let's go to another one that's less, I guess, difficult to talk about. And that's The Aquatope on White Sand. This is finally finished after 2 seasons, of course. It went 2 core. But Shiroi Suna no Aquatope. The Aquatope went sand. This one streamed on Crunchyroll, ran for 24 episodes, done by Studio PA Works. It was an original. Slice of Life was the genres. Director was Toshiya Shinohara, who did Lone Sea, Inuyasha movies, Lupin the Third movies. The writer for the series was credited to Yuko Kakihara, who did Tsukigakure, Digimon Try, and Chiayafuru. So, at least some work on those. This one follows a girl named Fuka, and she has decided recently that she wants to quit being an idol. She was actually in a group and everything, and kind of goes into some aspect of this other girl wanting to be the center for her grandmother, and then she decides to quit. And even though, you know, they were kind of mentioning the idea that she didn't want to try hard and all this kind of stuff, you kind of see the reason that she has for quitting. But eventually, she kind of wanders around, doesn't go immediately home. She decides to wander around until she finds herself in front of this big, huge aquarium called Gamagama. And she kind of goes inside Gamagama and looks around. She's, you know, loving the view of all the fish and everything. And eventually gets herself kind of swept up in some sort of vision of the fish and everything swimming around her and enveloping her. And then when she kind of comes to, she's standing in front of this girl named Kukuru. And Kukuru is actually the acting director of Gamagama. She's very young, but she's the active director there. And as you kind of find out over time, this aquarium apparently is going to be shutting down. Her grandfather, who owns the aquarium, he's kind of like, you know, old enough in age that he just wants to shut it down because, you know, it's getting old. The equipment's starting to get run down and he feels like it's better for the fish and everything that he just shuts the place down and finds the other fish homes that they can go to. And Kukuru doesn't want that because this is like a place that has a lot of special meaning to her. She's lost her parents. They came together and she wants to save this aquarium. So Fuka, not really having anything anymore because she just quit being an idol, decides, you know, she sees what Kukuru is going through and she wants to help Kukuru. Like, she's making it her new goal in life to help Kukuru with what she wants and her dreams, and Kukuru's dreams is to save the aquarium. So this kind of starts this whole thing where they're trying to save Gamagama, bring more people into it, advertise, you know, get new ideas in there, all that kind of stuff, deal with, you know, rundown equipment that they have to repair and stuff, all to save Gamagama and keep it from shutting down. So your thoughts on The Aquatope on White Sand?
I am of pretty much two minds of this show. In a lot of respects, I love this show. It has a lot of heart. There's a lot of really fantastic character moments in this show. I was trying to think of what exactly the term is for this, and I should have just went and looked it up, but how do you look up parallel kind of symbolisms type thing? It's not really something that you can just look up. I'm sure somebody will probably jump in and say, hey, Chris, this is what this term is, and I'll thank you ahead of time for pointing that out. There's, in a lot of cases, during the story, you'll see some situation that's happening in the background. And the characters are usually reacting to this situation in some way, shape, or form. It's especially relevant in the latter episode. You can really see it. It's like practically beating you over the head. Hey, this is means this. And so, but it is more subtle in some cases. In other cases, it's a lot more in your face. But what'll happen is there'll be something that the characters in general are reacting to, and they're discussing this, and then it's directly relevant to almost like the storyteller going, hey, this is what your main characters are dealing with, and this is something to kind of make you think about this thing in a way. This is the direction that I'm going. So it's kind of a symbolism back behind the main course. And like I said, there's a literary term for it, I know, but
drawing parallels.
Like I say, it is kind of a parallel.
I was getting that. What I was trying to get where you were talking about, I'm like, yeah, I kind of referenced a lot in my later videos of how much it was drawing comparisons and parallels to so many situations.
Yeah, the parallels are
like
all
the dolphin.
The dolphin was obviously
referencing something. There was a little bit of a parallel being drawn. All you had to do was slap Kukuru's face on the side of that dolphin, you had it.
But it's great. I do love a lot of
see
that.
Umiya out there like trying to tattoo his face on the side of the, I think we're referencing something. The old man literally is out there going, come back, granddaughter. Oh wait, you're not Kukuru. So we drawing enough comparisons here? Anyway, sorry.
Yeah. The old man talking to the manager and said, did my daughter figure it out yet? No, she's still stuck in the. I mean, that's the dolphin. You know, no, your daughter is still stuck in this situation.
The last conversation with the grandfather was so great for that. It was like, it was such a like. I was joking about my video, and I'm not going to say exactly what happens because it'd be kind of spoilers, but. I had this moment in my impressions video where I'm like, if this was a comedy, after the grandfather said what he said and Kukuru accepted it, you would have like him turn around and go, oh, good, she bought it. Like, it was literally a no answer. It was such a no answer. Like, what is the meaning of life? Whatever you make it. You're right. she bit. Good. I'm good. I'm out of here. Sorry, guys. We're so derailing.
That's how on the nose some of the symbolism is. The parallel symbolism. It's just that on the nose. And at the same time, there is other ones that are more subtle in nature. But it's fun to think about this when you go through and watch the show. And so these are the things that I truly love about it, other than the fact that it's a beautiful show. This BNPA works. This is obviously one of the ones that they kind of really wanted to put a lot of effort into. Now, on the downside to this, there is a lot of times where I almost felt almost like it was dragging on a lot of things. I mean, like I said, there being some absolutely excellent character points that did push me through in a lot of situations, but I can't deny I did drop off of the show at least three or four times, and I ended up catching up several times, having to finish off the last four or five episodes six episodes, if I remember right, just to get caught up for this, the final review. That's how frustrating some of this stuff was to get through. Not that I hated it. It was hard to get through some of this stuff. It felt pretty slow in a lot of cases.
And that was kind of where I was at, was it's the whole aspect of, especially the second half, it just feels like it's just spinning its wheel. It's like, are we really, like, Kukuru is just up and down, up and down, up and down. Okay, we introduced a new character. Kukuru's up and down, up and down. Okay, let's get into this character. Okay, Kukuru's up and down, up and down, up and down. But no, I think in a pure sense, it's a great slice of life. I think if you're looking for a solid, just straight up slice of life, you cannot go wrong. And it's pretty much the case with anything that's PA works. Really, they do a lot of very good slice of life shows. And I think they had a really solid cast to work with. It was a great cast. PA works did an excellent job visually. It looked beautiful. Even the CGI fish looked really beautiful and didn't, have any kind of conflict with art style or anything like that. It looked really good. I think the thing is that, especially the first core was way great. Like, I love the first core. Great character developments. Kukuru is going through so much. It had so many great pinnacle peaks of, like, just pure emotion. Like, I got teared up so many times watching the first season. Like there was, okay, one other aspect of the story is that there's this, what's it called? Kimimuji? I forget what the heck the name is. There's, like, this little deity thing that's in the area. It's a trickster. They call it a trickster, I believe. And this folklore, this trickster will make people see visions. And so, obviously, as you're kind of seeing in the background, there's this, like, weird, like, folklore creature in the background that nobody can ever see, but he's constantly around. And the weird thing that came of Gamagama, and it was a special thing about Gamagama, and it was one of the reasons why Kukuru wanted to save it so much, was that people in there, in Gamagama, when they have issues and things and troubles are facing, they'll often see visions of things that kind of comfort them or give them a little push. And so one thing, one example they have is when the old man comes in and he's a little bit torn up by the idea they're shutting down. And he wanted to come there one more time because he wanted to see his brother again. And they're like, what are you talking about, your brother? Well, one time I came here after I lost this company that I opened with my brother, I seen my brother. And he was obviously passed away. And that was the same with Kukuru. She's able to see her parents that have passed away. And even this other vision of this other person, which they get into a mystery about. So there's something special there. And it kind of, I totally forgot why I brought up that whole thing. But that creature is kind of that thing in the background that they're always kind of looking at that really did create a lot of emotion. Seeing visions of her mother was emotional. Having this old man tear up because he sees his brother is like super emotional. It's like you can't get any better than that kind of stuff. And that's what Gamagama was creating. And that was that whole, that first core had so many key points like that, that you really did want to get into and you really enjoyed. And all the characters had significant character growth that entire time. Kuya, Kai, Kukuru, Fuka herself sees so much growth in that first time. And then the second half comes in. And it feels like the whole driving force of the first core is lost. And it just kind of gets lost. That second core, it feels like it gets lost. And not only that, they introduce a lot of new characters. And while, yes, each of those characters have their own stories, especially Chiyu, who is in the first core as well, they get into her, and there was a lot of interesting stuff there. But for the most part, the characters are already established. Like, even Fuka herself, her character development's done. It's only Kukuru that's kind of still left behind. Like, she's the only one that still needs to find what she really wants to do. Like, do you want to save Gamagama? Is Gamagama your future? Is Gamagama your everything? Or is there something else you're going to do? And she has that conflict. But like I said earlier, it feels like it's just spinning its wheels. She feels like she gets it, and then she doubts herself. And then she feels like she gets it, and then she doubts herself. And it feels like it spends way too much time on her just bouncing around, that it wasn't as interesting as the second half. Like, you had me in the first half, and in the second half you just didn't completely lose me, but it just lost a lot of its charm. And I think that's my biggest issue, was that so much emotion, so much character, so much like pure slice of life goodness was in that first core. And the second core was just really more focused on work, I guess is it. I think when I did my review, because this like feels like a long time ago that I did my review, I felt like it was an opposite of Shirobako. The whole thing that I loved about Shirobako was that despite the fact that the first half was like, I struggled to get through it because it was so heavy drama. Now, this isn't like heavy drama, but it gets there. Like, heavy work drama. And then the second half of Shirobako was me literally rooting for the cast. Like, I love you guys. Please succeed. And it felt like this, but backwards. Like, in the first half, I'm like, I'm pleading. I love you guys. I want you to succeed. And the second half is just work stress. So it's like, I guess, I don't know. It was a huge struggle for me. And not that I hated it. It just felt like so much of the charm and so many of the good points were just in the first half, and the second half just, it was just there, I guess. And I didn't really, it just lost its driving force. That's literally where it's at. It just loses its driving force. Its core feature just kind of gets lost. And that's, like I said, super unfortunate because I did love it early on, but it is what it is. But either way, I think if you like, especially a lot of the PA works, you know, at work titles they've done, like Shirobako, Sakura Quest, Hanasaki Roha, you're going to find some of that same flavor here. Some really good writing. It's just, I think it almost feels like they were only intending for one season, but you know that they had plans for the second season, like the second core. The second core felt like an integral part of the story. It's just, I think too much time. Like, they had way too many episodes to work with or something. It feels like that. Like, I only wrote for like 14 episodes. Make it 24. That kind of feeling. So it is what it is. In the end, I did enjoy it, but just keep that level. So yeah. Akatopa White Sand. Check that out if that's interesting to you. My senpai is annoying, or senpai ga uzai kohai no hanashi. This one streamed for 12 episodes. What is stream on? I don't have the streaming platform on here, and it totally broke my brain. I have a pattern, Animation? People. I have a pattern here. I have a
Crunchyroll.
No, it was Funimation.
Was it?
Yeah, I think so.
You just said that you weren't sure.
No, I'm joking about the fact that I have a pattern of going down the list, and when it's not all filled out, my brain breaks. Anyways, it was streamed on Funimation, ran for 12 episodes, done by Studio Dogokobo. I can never fix myself. Sources of manga. Genres are comedy, romance, slice of life. And this one follows a 22-year-old office worker named Futaba. And Futaba Igarashi, she is very short, very underdeveloped, enough that everybody kind of mistakes her for being a junior high schooler. But even still, she doesn't let that keep her down. She goes to work and everything, and she's working in a sales department at a company under a senpai whose name is Harumi Takeda. And just so happens, Takeda is extremely huge, very loud, very muscular, and loves to tease the fact that she's small and short and everything. Well, I don't know that he does every now and then, but he doesn't really actively tease her. It's just obviously she has a complex. That's just obvious. But anyways, either way, she fights through it. And over time, you kind of see them as they work together, do sales calls and different speeches and stuff. At the same time, on the side, you'll see other office workers in there, namely Toko Sakurai and Sota Kazuma. And it really does seem like, obviously, very quickly, the two of them are kind of into each other. And it's mainly around the idea that Sakurai is very beautiful, very popular. And it always seems like Kazuma, he thinks that, you know, he doesn't have a stand a chance for Sakurai because he just thinks that she's just way out of his league. But he always kind of does things to kind of help her get out of situations. So she really quickly, you know, kind of attaches to him. And he never seems to get a hint that she's kind of interested in him. But yeah, your thoughts?
This show was absolutely adorable. The kind of it's one of those things that where the one character really likes the other character, and the other character is just really warm and genuine, and you don't know if he really does have a thing for her or not, but he definitely is just really an awesome
Takeda
guy.
Is so cool.
He is such a cool guy.
It was so funny because when I get into the show, I was like, okay, this is gonna be all about contrast. Let's get the punchlines. It's gonna be cute. And then I realized really quickly, Takeda's really cool, dude. I mean, Igarashi, if you don't want to get into this guy, I'll jump in there. This is a cool dude. Just so much energy. He's infectious. That was the best way that I put it early on, was that he's infectious. Like, his positive loudness, he just, like, does his nice, gruffy bear laugh and stuff. And you're just like, dude, I want to hug this guy. He's so cool.
And this...
He's only second to Kendro Suda, though. Don't get me wrong.
and this show, this is how a lot of the characters in general come off. I mean, as you go through the cast of characters, each one of them, you genuinely find some kind of a
everybody's great except for the guys that hit on Sakurai. Screw those two.
Yeah, they
could, well, mainly one of them, but still, yeah, I think everybody else was cool.
I mean,
and the drunk girl. I didn't care much for the drunk girl.
Mona
Tsukishiro. She's just always like, here, I got whiskey. I'm not actually drinking, though. She's
She didn't bother me.
The noodle scene was fun, though.
When it comes down to it, each one of these characters, I just found some genuine enjoyment of being around him. I'm talking about mostly the main cast in general. But
yeah, not the guy that hits on Sakurai.
Let's
keep pointing that out.
I really, really loved Futaba's childhood friend. Like Andrew was talking about, Sakurai and Kazuma and the little brother. Each one of these characters were just absolute. They had hearts of gold, and I genuinely found myself just rooting for them. So I genuinely just rooted for each one of them as the stories progressed, and I really did enjoy when not necessarily enjoyed them getting sick, but I enjoyed seeing the
debilitating illness episodes. The debilitating illness episodes.
I loved seeing Takeda taking care of Futaba during that episode, or some of the other episodes involved in the basketball.
I'm surprised Sakurai scenes. And Kazuma didn't have a debilitating illness.
I know,
episode.
Right?
That would have been interesting. Sakurai's like super waifu material. Like, I totally thought I was just gonna be like straight into the and that's the funny thing.
She is absolutely
Like super cute. And of course the best seiyuu ever for that role. I mean, I just love that seiyuu so much. She's her seiyuu is like super, like, I love that voice. Like you hear that voice and it's, oh my gosh, that girl. But no, it was one of those cases where I'm like, similar to TZ Master Takagi-san. Is you have that like whole element where you have the main shtick is these two, and it's like that fear of, okay, the moment they shift perspective and you start focusing on somebody else, you're like, don't do that, you're gonna ruin the show. Oh wait, I really like Sakurai. It wasn't the case like Teasing Master Takagi-san where it gets to those other side three girls and it's like, wait, go back to Takagi-san and and what's his face, I can't remember his name, Nishikata. But no, it was great. Like, and it was crazy because they had like four whole episodes to them.
Yeah.
I mean, granted, it would, you know, tilt over every now and then, which it happens with even with Futaba's episodes. But no, they had like literally four episodes to really get into them. And I'm like, wow, they're spending a lot of time on these two. I'm actually very surprised, which is perfectly fine again because Sakurai is like super waifu material here. But no, anyways, are you done?
Yeah, pretty much. I love it. Please go watch it. If you enjoy the stuff that I enjoy, you'll love this one.
Okay, yeah, so I didn't like the show at all. In the end, I didn't like this show. I'm just joking. No, I love the show. It was so great. Like, I think I've gotten most of my points out in the idea that, like, it totally expected this to be just straight, you know, here's contrast joke, it's cute. Dogo Kobo is getting involved. They do, like, the OP is, you can't skip it. Like, that OP, you can't skip it. Did you skip it?
I had a very hard time, but yes, I did.
You skipped it? Yeah. I skipped it once.
I love the I wanted to watch a lot of shows.
My gosh, I'm sorry, people. You can direct your hate emails to Chris from otakuspirit.com @.com. I don't remember. He doesn't have an email. Anyways, he doesn't have an Otaku Spirit email. But no, it's, yeah, like I said, going into it was expecting it just to be the contrast joke. But like I said, it was one of those things where every minute it surprises me. It does something with it. It does something with this. And my other thing that I kind of had, like, here's my layout of my expectations coming into it. Skit-based comedy is going to cut from, like, scene to scene. It's going to be another joke around the, you know, contrast. I figured, again, Takeda was just going to be this guy that annoys the heck out of her. I assumed that it was going to be, what was the other thing that I had? Something else that I had all these expectations that I was kind of setting for myself coming into it. But when I was expecting it to be pure comedy. And what I got from it was, yes, Takeda's really cool. I love these two together. They're so cute together. The relationship builds. It gets into Sakurai and Kazuma. Their relationship builds. It was more slice of life than comedy.
That
was a huge shock for me. This show is very slice of life, work, comedy kind of stuff. But a lot more development to the characters and a more through storyline than I originally anticipated.
It's the title in a way is kind of misleading. It implies that I think we even talked about the idea of we were expecting this to be kind of almost a backwards teasing girl, where it was kind of a almost like Takeda is honestly teasing Futaba, and in all actuality, they even set it up in such a way where you get the idea of she is obviously has a thing about her size. That is an absolute thing. But even in the latter episodes where they actually explain what ended up happening between the two that kind of set her off in this weird situation with Takeda, where she came in, he thought she was a high school student who was visiting the office. And
we're going to like insult the heck out of her. And then like, oh yeah, by the way, you're working with her. And she's like, I want somebody else.
And so that kind of set the tone for those two and their relationship.
Thought it was a school tour.
Right. And from that point on, he actually is actually very respectful of her. There is another reference to it that does come in a bar meeting where, he says something inadvertently that kind of sets her off as well. It was
like in the first episode.
Exactly.
He says, I wish I had a daughter like you.
Exactly.
And it's like, whoa, that was bad.
And it was,
why can't I be the wife?
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing is these are the things that he's not doing these things in on purpose. And when it comes down to it,
tousling her hair is not a good thing either.
Well, the tousling, I think that's about as far as him teasing her as he does is the tousling the hair, because that drives her nuts. But when it comes down to it, my point is that in a lot of these cases, he's not doing it in most cases to annoy her. His annoyance is his almost denseness to
His good nature.
Yeah, his good nature that kind of sets her off, and that's why it's annoying. So, like I said, it's kind of misleading.
To go to your point, I mean, what is one of the first scenes they have is they're going to a presentation for a company, and he purposely slows down because obviously her strides are much shorter than his, so she has to like literally walk, you know, three steps just to get one of his steps. And so he slows down. She feels like he's basically looking down on her by slowing down. And she's like, no, don't do that. And she's like, no, it's fine. She's like, no, don't do that. And she finally is like, okay. And he starts going, and she has to putt to get, you know, keep up with him enough that it kind of exhausts her. But again, he's going out of his way to, you know, help her out. It's not a looking down thing. It's just a, you know, it's a courtesy thing to do. But yeah, they're just cute together. Just a fun couple. And like I said, it's not like it's trying to advance a relationship or anything like super quick. You just really kind of see that they're just golden together. They work so well together, and a lot to that to do with the fact that Takeda is such a cool guy. I mean, he goes out of his way to help her, especially like when we have the whole debilitating illness episode, or there was one episode where she's like super scared because I think she watched a horror movie or something like that. That kind of stuff is really sweet. It was just a really sweet little couple. And then you throw the big, burly grandfather into the mix, and that's great as well, because then they have to, like, turn into a competition there.
Literally everybody sees these two together except for Takeda.
Yeah. But no, it was really sweet. And like I said, just an absolute treat to have Sakurai and Kazuma on the side to kind of give a different little cute story to go along with it, which, again, equally with them, getting a full four episodes, really not a full, but again, mostly four episodes to work with. You see that development there. And then again, they have the same kind of issues there. Sakurai has issues in her past where she was, it kind of seemed like she was bullied because of the fact that she looked so pretty. And then equally with Kazuma and his insecurities with, you know, the fact that he feels that he's out of her league kind of thing, even though he doesn't really get the hints. Really cute stuff. Just a great little couple. Like I said, a lot more slice of life. And we're not talking about like a super drama slice of life, just a very laid back, fun slice of life that I was really, like I said, not really expecting from this series. I thought it was just going to be skit based, get the punchlines, move to the next scene kind of stuff. And it wasn't really that. So it was a treat. It was an absolute treat. And like I said, Dogo Kobo did a fantastic job. Really good at it. So My Senpai's Annoying. Check that out. Recommendation. The Faraway Paladin, or Saite no Paladin, streaming on Crunchyroll, ran for 12 episodes. They already have a second season announced, which is fantastic. Studio is Children's Playground Entertainment. Sources, light novels, genres, art, adventure, fantasy, action, mystery, psychological. The director that worked on this was Yu Nobata, who did High School Fleet, Kuma 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 Bear, and Maitsetsu. The series composition by Tatsuya Takahashi, who did Idolmaster, Cinderella Girls, Domestic Girlfriend, Beatless, and Eromanga Sensei. So yeah, this one, I hate saying this, it's an isekai where a guy gets transported into the body of an infant, and when he kind of, you know, gains his consciousness in this new fantasy world, he is an infant in the arms of three undead beings that are kind of secluded in a tome out in the middle of nowhere. And these three undead are Blood, who is a skeleton warrior, Gus, who is a wizard ghost, and then Mary, who is a mummy that is a priestess. And as he's kind of being raised by these three undead, they're kind of teaching about the world, teaching about the gods, teaching about everything of history and everything, kind of instilling knowledge of magic, prayer, and obviously being a warrior, because blood is a warrior. And so as he grows up, it seems you get a quick idea that it feels like there's a two-sided secrecy here. Will doesn't really reveal to them that he is from another world, even though he kind of has a hazy knowledge that he was in a previous world. It doesn't seem like he has a full knowledge of what his life was, but he doesn't reveal that to them. At the same time, it seems like these three are keeping something from Will. There's like this secrecy. They're kind of keeping something away from him until eventually he becomes of an age where they're going to do one final trial for him to train him and teach him. And after this trial, they end up revealing everything about this significant occurrence that happened. Was it 200 years ago or something like that?
Something like that.
That there was this mad king that was feared throughout the land, that was on this big, huge escapade across the country, just killing everybody in sight. He was super powerful, was like this undead king, was unable to die. He wielded a weapon that kind of sucked the life force from other people and healed himself. And he was like, such chaos was being created because demons were being summoned, and the demons were sacrificing humans to create more demons. And then eventually it got so chaotic that the gods themselves even appeared to get involved. But after this, you know, basically the dust settled, he was sealed away. It seems like what goals these three had is kind of been completed. And so this stagnant, this undead god that appeared to essentially make them undead, appears, and things happen. I'll just say that. I don't want to get too much details there. But this basically leads to Will to going out adventuring to the world, because at that time, he becomes a disciple of this kind of unknown god, Gracefield. And Gracefield is like this goddess of light. And so he basically, now a disciple of Gracefield, now having selected a deity, goes about the world to bring light to the furthest reaches of the world, the greatest darkness or whatever. So that's kind of the start of his journey. So, your thoughts on The Faraway Paladin, a show that literally is half of it is world building.
I really enjoy this show. The big problem with this show is that it's such a slow burn show. And I think that a lot of people will have a really hard time getting through a lot of the show. Like Andrew was saying, when he says half of this show is world building, he's not joking. This show takes its time, very much is methodical in how it's relaying all of the things that are going on in this story, which is, I'm not going to say a lot, because when all is said and done, once you get everything done, it feels like you got a very solid story out of this, for sure. From Will, pretty much his entire life, from literally him being reborn all the way up until a certain thing that has just recently happened, which was an absolutely, to me, it was a fantastic chapter close where they put it. But when it comes down to it, when you take the entire thing in retrospective, you stop and think about it. While there was while it kind of feels like a lot was there, when it comes down to it, if you take all the story beats, there wasn't a lot that happened. It just this, and this. So four general, pretty much arcs is pretty much a training arc, a battle, a introduction to a couple of new characters, and then another battle, and pretty much is what happened. So it's really frustrating in that respect, but like I said, it's a lot of the pacing is it, and it's methodical, just slow, and it's a very slow burn show, but it's still I'm getting stuck on it's how slow it is, but
super slow.
It is a slow show. When it comes down to it, it's a great show because the story is a very intriguing. It's a very intriguing story. And it's a story that I did feel like I wanted to keep going from week to week. I definitely, this was definitely, once it was up on the list, I wanted to watch it because there is a hook involved in the show, and it's a story that I definitely wanted to be involved with. I enjoyed it very much.
Okay, I was waiting for you to say it again so I could interrupt you. No, I absolutely love this show. Now, I echo Chris's concern is this: the pacing of the show is extremely slow. I think it was only saved, honestly, when we were getting to the point where it was getting late in the series. I'm like, this show is going to go nowhere. And I think that once the show's in, my biggest concern is going to be I can't recommend it because it's not going to feel like it did enough for the investment. The investment is in reference to how much building it does before it goes out and does something with that buildup. You can only build the background so much behind the characters before you need to start doing some drawing of the characters themselves. And I felt like it did tons to paint that background. And that background has got so much dang detail in it, you can just hang it on the wall alone. But you got to do something with it. You have to put something in the forefront or the foreground. And I feel like we only barely started doing that. He barely started getting his feet out there and walking around. And so I felt like if this was going to be a single core adaptation, I wasn't going to be able to recommend it.
Yeah.
Honestly, there's no way I was going to be able to recommend the show with just single core. But thankfully, they announced, I think when the 11th episode aired, that they were going to do a second season. I'm like, okay, good. Thank you. Now let's talk. It's like, okay, good. Now let's talk about Faraway Paladin. This show is great, you know, kind
of
thing.
It's one of those things that I almost wanted to say, I almost want to wait until I see the second season. It's frustrating.
I think probably for a different reason. What they hinted at the very end of the season was that this might start focusing on nation building.
Yep.
Did you get that feeling too?
Yes, I seen that.
Yeah, I'm like, they literally just it almost felt like somebody just attached something to his leg and threw down an anchor. I'm like, oh, please don't. This story needs to have him going to the faraway areas. But at the same time, it pretty much established that the whole concept of what he's doing would be facilitated by him staying there.
And the funny thing is I got such a kick out of, and this is such a, in a way it's a spoiler, but only if you know what I'm talking about, is there was a comment and then a smile of a certain character. And it was like,
yeah.
I got such a kick out of that particular scene. Why? Because it was meant to happen. And I loved it. Yeah. It was a confirmation of that was what was meant.
That's again where I kind of struggle. I think this is at its best when he's traveling and doing exactly what it could. Let me get into my enjoyment of the show. Because, yes, I think the world building was fantastic. I was eating up how much work and how much depth was being put to this world. And it made sense to the world itself. Everything made sense, what they were laying out. A lot of times it was really hard to follow. Because they were getting some heavy stuff. Like, this wasn't just Gus comes up to young Will and says, okay, now let's talk about the gods. Here's the, I think it was like, 13 gods. Here's all the names of them. It's getting into the names. It's getting into, like, stories about, like, conflicts that they had. It's getting into, like, the full-depth backstories of some of them. It's like, this writer put so much emphasis on these deities. Obviously, they're going to be an integral point of the story. And yeah, sure enough, the moment that Stagnant shows up, you're like, yeah, this is more than just these people believe in something that may or may not exist. This is a world that has gods in it. It has everybody essentially at some point in their life will choose one of these gods to serve. And
If you make a deal with a god, you follow through with that deal.
Yeah, and it was great because they even went further with the whole aspect and how important that is with Mary. Mary was like this way of showing how important it is to stick to that, because it gets to some point where she essentially betrayed her god and went with another god in order to fulfill a contract. And what happens is she still serves her god, but because of like the essentially the rule sets of the world itself, she's burned alive. Not really burned alive, she's dead already, but she's engulfed in flames as she's praying because she essentially broke that pact. But you still see that determination in her. Like I said, they're doing so many cool things to really instill into your mind everything about this world and the rules and everything. It's so well fleshed out. But that was the frustration, the fact that it took literally upwards of 6 episodes to really lay all that stuff out. And so there is a fear at that point of going beyond that. But even beyond that, it was setting up something really great, because Will himself is a really cool dude. He's a guy that you want to back up and or back, back, yeah, back, back up. And it's really cool, because the thing that I noticed really quickly was like, holy crap, this is a rare thing, because you don't really get a story about a warrior of light. Typically, the paladins and the god, the paladins and the popes and the churchgoers, they're typically evil people in every show. Let's be honest. Like, you never really get good, unless it's a cute nun that's in an ecchi show or something, but they're typically controlled by an evil pope. Let's be honest. We don't really have a good perspective of that disciple of some god or goddess. And this is a rare case of that. Like, he's going out into these locations. He's praying for people. He's healing the wounded. He's freeing the those that are, like, undead. He's freeing them from that so they can go back into the cycle. He's doing all these great things in service of this deity, this Gracefield. And I really like that. It was like, wow, this is a literal paladin. Like, we don't really get this kind of a storytelling. It's really cool. And you even have characters like Meneldor, who's, like, mocking him at some point. Like, why do you keep praying to this lady? And eventually, like, comes this thing of, like, his actions eventually change his mind about serving a deity. I thought it was really cool. It's, a different take on the Warrior of Light, the Man of the Cloth, that you just don't really get in these stories. He's a genuinely cool dude. But he's not perfect. Don't get me wrong. And I honestly was going to say at some point, like, man, this guy's, like, super cool, and he's almost a little bit too good. But no, yeah. At some point towards the later part of the show, it really does get into this idea that, no, he gets caught up on things too. And he screws up. And he kind of corrects his path. He almost feels like he's a demon of some sort, like a monster. And I thought that was really cool. He still has those doubts in there. But he's still always serving Gracefield. And I thought it was a really cool, different take, again, on the Man of Cloth aspect.
No, I absolutely agree. He is definitely a flawed character, and I love that about him. The other thing going into what you were saying, and I don't know if you mentioned it when you were doing your review, but I actually kind of thought about it in a similar vein of the fact that he technically had his quote unquote corruption chance will kind of, make him immune in the future, which is actually one of those really cool things that in a lot of cases, the quote unquote, like Andrew was saying, the Warrior of Light, at some point, the Paladin will have a corruption arc where he's going to face his inner demons, and he's going to go through this really dark moment, and will he come back to the light side? Technically, he's already done that, and that was in
Grace
his
feels
setup.
Too hot. He's never going to betray her.
Yeah, and Grace feels
too hot. She's never going to betray her.
But yeah, since he's technically...
I would betray Stagnant because he ain't hot. But Gracefield ain't gonna turn against her. I don't know why she's the least popular. I mean, she's the hottest out of all of them. Of course, we haven't really seen the true form of all of them. So,
but yeah, and my point being is that he's... with him technically already going through that situation, he is kind of immune from it in the future. So while they may try to corrupt him at some point, he's not going to be very corruptible. And that makes him an even more interesting character, because he's something new, something that we haven't really had done before.
Yeah. I think, to get into my only other, I have two other negatives. One is the animation has issues later on, especially in the later half. It's rough. It's real rough. And I got frustrated with that aspect, because early on I really liked it. I love the visual style. It's got like this almost kind of not quite like color pencil kind of roughness to it, but almost like a filter on it. It reminded me a lot of Mushoku Tensei. It has almost like a filter of a very soft color to it. And I really like that. But like I said, early on, I was fine with it. There was a couple like the fight with blood early on. It looks a little rough, but for the most part, it moves. It wasn't until like the later parts where it starts to get like character starts to look wonky and stuff. They had like this one bar scene where B comes in and she's talking with this new guy that they recruit later on. And it's just like, is she really sitting in that chair? It doesn't look like she's sitting in that chair. It looked really rough. So I'm hoping the second season they get, hopefully, it seemed like it wasn't really so much a budget issue. It's more of a, I think they were probably having issues towards a later part with scheduling and keeping on schedule. But I do hope that they get a better quality in the second half. My other issue that I have is the why isekai question I always give. Yes, I'm going to do it with Fireway Paladin. Every isekai I watch, I always have the question of why isekai. Mashuka Tensei is a very rare example where I think it's perfectly logical. It's an isekai. It plays in with the story perfectly. Tsukimichi Moonlit Fantasy. That one, I don't question it. It utilizes the isekai element. But there's a lot of isekais out there where at some point in the show you go, why is this character even isekai? What's the point? And this is a dire example of that. I don't get why this character has to be isekai. He could have easily been born in this world. Nothing he's done so far requires him to have been isekai. He's brought up two times or something like that. Yeah, the Haxor thing just lets me know that he was from a world in 2000 because nobody says Haxor since then. That comment. Plus, one other point, he said something to the effect that he feels like he'd let somebody down in the previous world. And that was it. The rest of it has never really played off of it. I'm sure at some point, way later in the story, it might bring it up and be some significance. But for now, it's a YA isekai for me. And I hate that because my argument always with that is that if it weren't for the fact that he's isekai from his other world, I could easily recommend people, hey, you love fantasy shows? Watch this show. It's not isekai, is it? No, watch it. But the fact that it's isekai is a stigma. And it makes me want some shows to not be isekai. But anyways, yeah, I really enjoyed it. Like I said, it had a phenomenal startup. Combat. I love the combat sequences. Despite, again, my issues with animation, especially later on when they get into like CGI Chimera and stuff. I love the combat in the show because it seems like the writer is very meticulous about combat. It's not just a guy takes out sword and slashes enemy and the enemy dies. It's not guy walks out there, uses fireball, all the enemies die. This is very, like I said, meticulous in that it's a very step-by-step combat. So he comes up, like early on, he has this point where he goes down in this kind of crypt and he takes out this one enemy. And then he goes around the corner. He notices a certain type of undead, like a demon undead kind of thing. And so he knows that thing, based on the knowledge that was given to him by his parents, essentially Gus, Blood, and Mary, that's going to be a spell-casting monster. So he immediately prepares himself to cast a silence spell the moment it starts casting a spell. And then he'll use this other thing to bind it down, and then he'll take it down. Like, it's very meticulous, a step-by-step. It's not just, again, slashing and pew-pewing. It's very tactical-based combat, and I really love that. Like, the moment that he first meets this first village, he just comes out there and starts doing all these different spells, the counterspell, silence, acceleration, all these cool things that he's doing in order to master the fight. It's not just he's so overpowered he destroys everything. He does have – it does kind of give a sense that he is a lot stronger than everybody else, but it's obviously a lot of the knowledge that was instilled upon him the moment he was born by these three. And so it feels like a gained strength, equally with knowledge. And I love that writer is so meticulous about the fight scenes. Even the very last fight was really cool because it's laying out, okay, I know what this thing is. I know how it works. I know how to confuse it. I'm going to do this in order to confuse it before I can put in the final blow. It's very meticulous about its combat. And that's something, again, that gets me really excited for what it can do in the future, just because I know the writer isn't simple about his combat sequences. So,
and you know, everybody, all they heard is that we were complaining about it being too slow.
It is really slow.
When I finally was able to get away from the slow thing, we can sit here
and praise it slow again.
Yeah, praise it. Praise See, it for they 20
probably,
minutes.
No, they probably have forgotten about that, but then you had to remind them at the end of the review. So now they're like, oh yeah, that's right. He was going on about being slow. If you can, if you can stick through that kind of slow nature, and again, I think if you're somebody that really loves world building, it's just doing that in spades. And I really hope that it does something with it. And again, it goes back to the whole second season thing. And I think even then, when that show comes around, unless they continue on after the second season and keep going, I don't know. I would assume it's probably just going to get two season, and it's probably a lot to do with the fact they knew that one season is not going to be enough to really sell the show because you're not quite there yet. But depending on where that second season goes, it can be like either a huge praise for it or not. So
I am kind of curious as to how much more. I do know that the writer went hiatus or is very, very slowly trickling this story out or something like that. I know he's very active and is very engaging, especially even with the Western audience.
Oh yeah. Please don't remind me.
Did something bad happen with that?
Yes.
Oh no.
Anime News Network made some stupid comment was basically bashing Faraway Paladin, then start bashing Mushoku Tensei, and then the writer himself even replied to the whole situation, like, you know, look, I really love Mushoku Tensei, and I got a lot of inspiration from it. It's a really good story. It just felt bad, because it's like, please, Japanese writers and stuff, don't follow Anime News Network. It's not the Western audience. We love your show. We really do. Don't take their. It's slow. Yes, we did talk about how slow it was a lot, but we still love your show.
Yeah.
So, question: if you can honestly remember all the shows this year, what would you put this show for 2021? I know it's obviously going to be under Mushoku Tensei, unless I don't know. I'm not going to make an assumption for you. I'm thinking this is third. Under Mushoku Tensei and Tsukimichi. I don't think this beats Mushoku Tensei for me. But Mushoku Tensei is for a different reason. Tsukimichi is for a different reason. Like I said, Faraway Paladin and Tsukimichi are kind of like neck and neck for second. Obviously, Mushoku Tensei is number one, no doubt. But I think they do two different things between this and Tsukimichi. And I think Tsukimichi, based on the fact that we really haven't gotten too far into Wheel's actual journey.
This is the frustrating thing, because I think somebody was talking to me about this and during one of my live streams, and they wanted me to put this on the top of the list. And it's like, I know you want me to put it there, but when it comes down to it, it's not fair for me to put this in, because I even said the same thing when it came to Mushoku Tensei and Ascendance of the Bookworm. I didn't feel that. At the time, Jobless Reincarnation had gotten to the same level as Ascendance of the Bookworm. And when I'm being fair about it, yes, now I would put them on the same level. And honestly, Bookworm has dropped to my number two spot, if I'm being fair. When it comes down to it, with this one, it's not fair for me to put it on the same level as Jobless Reincarnation in any way, shape, or form. There's just too much in Jobless Reincarnation where... To be fair...
Oh, even with the first season of Jobless Reincarnation, that would beat this one.
Yeah, that's the thing. To be fair, this show is a very, very slow burn. But putting this in one season anywhere near the same level as Jobless Reincarnation is not fair in any way, shape, or form. That's severely understating what Jobless Reincarnation is doing. I'm not saying this is a bad show. I'm just saying that...
slow.
I'm saying that this one is a lot more slower burn. It is trying to tell a much more broader story. Now, if we get three seasons into this show, and when all is said and done, I may very much change my way about how I feel about this, mostly because when it comes down to it, as much as is being done in the background, when all these threads come together, it has the potential to be a very, very massive story. However, if you're taking it from Will's perspective, if it's only Will's story, and this is really hard to kind of to express this is very difficult, mostly because...
You do know that you have an entire just deliberations podcast to talk about this if you're going to get super deep with this.
I know, right?
And we're literally going to do that in a week. just letting you know.
It's like having a massive just buffet of a whole bunch of ingredients, and you have two pieces of toast or two pieces of bread. Will is the bread, and you have all those ingredients.
You're not going to use my portrait theory here. You're just going to make your own with a buffet.
No. My point being is, when it comes down to it, when all is said and done, after you get through two seasons, you're not going to get all those ingredients. No matter how many ingredients are in front of you, you're not going to get all those ingredients on a perfect sandwich. You're only going to get what Will can portray in his story. So, yes, there's a lot to this world. And if he can weave all these threads together, it'll be a fantastic story. But as it stands right now, I don't see a way to pull that off with as slow burn as the show is. It's too methodical.
Stop saying it slow. Just trying to help you.
Too slow burn.
Slow. You said slow, though.
Slow burn. It's too methodical in its pacing. He doesn't randomly just throw a whole bunch of stuff at you at one point. He takes his time, tells the story he wants to tell. All these other things are out there, and you hope that they'll make a difference later, but for what it is, it's all flavor text.
There you go. Faraway Paladin. We should probably move on.
Please.
Let's move on to Banish. This is stupid shows in the list. I don't want to talk about it. Crossage, moving on. So, banished from the hero's party, I decided to live a quiet life in the countryside. Or Shin no Nakama ja nai to Yusha no party wo oida sarata no de hinkyo de slow life suru koto ni shimashita. So glad I probably don't have to say that one again.
Side note. To answer your question, I'd put it in three right now if you're putting it up against
those. Oh, you should have finally answered that
technically,
question.
I never technically answered it.
There you go.
If those are the only three, I can't think of any other off the top of my head.
Nothing super huge, except for maybe World's Finest Assassin. I don't know where you put that.
I maybe would put it in the same level as Finest Assassin right now. But
Oof. I don't like you no more, Chris.
Anyway, I liked Assassin. So.
I liked it too, just not that much. Anyways, Banished from the Hero's Party. I would rather talk about that than Banished the Hero. We're going to talk about it anyways. Funimation's what streamed it.
This I would not put on my top list.
It is an isekai, obviously. I'm just saying that to make everybody mad. There's like a group of people that were so mad.
Andrew was so stuck on the isekai thing for a long time.
Only because somebody brought up that people are saying that it's going to be an isekai. And I'm like, now I'm going to joke about it because now it's a great joke because people are mad about it now. Not that I typically like to tease people like that. It's funny because I thought about that. Anyways, it's on Funimation. It ran for 13 episodes, done by Studio Flad and Wolfsbane. Source is a light novel. The genres are adventure, fantasy, romance, slice of life. Series composition was done by Megumi Shimizu, who did King's Raid and Villainous. My next life is a villainous. Yeah, this show pretty much opens up. This guy, I think he was Gideon at the time. He is the guide of the Heroes Party. What you find out in this world has, of course, demons, and there's a hero that will take on the demon lord. And this hero has a party, and this group is comprised of different members, such as a sage. Like I said before, Gideon is the guide of the party. Well, at some point, this sage tells Gideon, hey, look, you're kind of useless. You have no unique skills. You're not powerful in any way, and you don't pull your weight. The hero keeps having to save your butt in every fight that we get into, and you're going to end up getting the hero hurt. And as we find out, this hero, which is Ruti, is actually Gideon's sister. And so after a while, the sage kind of telling him, you know, look, you're useless. You're going to get her hurt. He eventually somehow, I've still to this day don't get it, somehow convinces Gideon that, yeah, I'm okay, I'll leave. I'll do it. Tell them that I went out scouting for the Demon Lord, and I never came back. Again, another stupid thing is he says, okay, but leave your stuff behind. And that's totally going to convince somebody that you left your gear behind, which they totally bring up later, which I thought was funny. I'm like, good. Somebody pointed out the fact that he left his gear behind. It doesn't make any sense. Nobody's fooled by the sage, by the way. But anyways, Gideon does this, leaves the party, ends up going to some remote town where he ends up trying to raise up money in order to open up an apothecary, which he uses to basically serve this village. Every now and then, bad things happen in the village, and he secretly takes care of it because he's taken on the new identity of Red. He doesn't want anybody to know that he was a part of the Heroes Party. And yeah, eventually, just so happens, this remote town out in the middle of nowhere that has no significance whatsoever, somehow this princess that he met during his journeys with the Hero Party somehow stumbles upon him and his little apothecary. And then she decides, because she's always had a kind of crush on him, that she's going to stay there and take and help him out with it. And which was kind of cool because she kind of points out all these things that he never thinks about that he should be thinking about with his new apothecary. And so he's like, okay, yeah, I guess I do need you. Come on aboard. She quickly tries to get a double bed so they can sleep together. He doesn't seem to get that that's an open invitation, but you know that she seemingly likes him a lot. But it kind of follows them as they have their little kind of slowly building relationship, building up this apothecary. And at the same time on the side, you see the Heroes Party kind of falling apart without its guide and them kind of actively seeking to find out where did Gideon go because they obviously need him. And then in the background, there's the blessings, which I guess we can get into eventually. So your thoughts?
Do I have to?
Are you as mixed as I am? I know Crossange.
I loved this show.
This is through Crossange for me.
I loved this show up until episode 11. I was so 11 burned.
Really? It took that long. I was with so the whole point burned. Where they were start like having people axing people in the middle of the streets and crossbowing.
I was so burned by episode 11. I got incensed, and episode 12 didn't save it for me. It didn't do anything for me. So when it all comes down to it, I like Red, I like Rit, I love Ruti, and I love Tisei. The rest of it can go and burn in a fire somewhere. What about
Wiggle Wiggle? I mean, I'm
Wiggle,
sorry,
Wiggle Wiggle, Wiggle Wiggle is cool. Wiggle, yeah, Wiggle he's cool.
Was it Wiggle Wiggle San?
I don't remember. He's the spider.
Mr.
He's cool.
Wiggly Wiggly.
I like. Yeah, I like the spider, but. It's frustrating. I like I said, I loved the show, really did. I liked the whole slow life. I loved the kind of love thing going on between Red and Rit.
A fantasy with romance.
Yeah,
and it goes pretty much all the way.
I liked
if
watching,
we were to believe that actually happened.
I liked the way they portrayed a lot of the stuff in the background, kind of the weird blessing system. It became more and more interesting, especially when they got into the devil blessing. I was on board with it. I was fine. I didn't think too much about it, so I just kept going with it. And then when episode 11 happened, I hate to say it this way, but it freaking jumped the shark, and it made me mad.
I'm trying to think of what happened in episode 11. Was it the part where the assassin becomes an airship pilot?
No, that was after this, or that was before this. This was where Eris went freaking ballistic. They pulled out some swords out of some freaking room. The swords randomly made Ruti go nuts.
That was 12.
No, that was, yeah, that was when she tried to attack Red. But, yeah, anyway, everything became a mess after episode 11. And it became really frustrating for me.
It was so funny because at some point, Chris's last week was like, hey, let's go ahead and do Banished Hero instead of this other show. And I'm like, Chris, the show's not done yet. Oh, it felt like it was done. I'm like, Chris, if you think that was the ending, I'd be making a video right now saying how terrible this show is if they stopped it there. Because that would be a bad spot to leave a show through and through. I'd be spitting flames on a video if that was
and I said I totally agree. I did not know there was another episode. I thought that was the last episode. I was furious about it at the time.
that's where you're mad is you thought that was the last episode. So it's all better after that point. And I never really got why Eris was the way he was. And I know why, but I never really got a hint that was part of why. But I guess that gets into my whole spiel. This show, to get into my thoughts, I think visually it was okay. I mean, they put a lot of effort into Rit, and I can give the animators credit for that. They know where to put the effort into, and that is to animate Rit as good as possible, because obviously she has assets that need a lot of attention and budget. Every time, I don't know, once an episode for probably half of the episodes, they have to show her in nothing but a t-shirt, and I was perfectly fine with that. They did a really incredible job animating that.
It was very, very beautiful scenes, especially the nighttime scenes when they had the moonlight going on to her. And
no, it's usually kind of the dawn of the morning kind of show.
We had those. We had the stream episode where they were sitting by the stream.
Oh yeah, the bikini episode. Yeah,
yeah. There's some beautiful scenes there.
Got to have bikinis in medieval times.
See, this is a great show as far as these things are concerned. It definitely had a lot of visually appealing scenes involved with Rit.
And it was like, besides that, the only other thing that really got a lot of tension was whenever Ruti fought. Like, there was a couple of fight scenes with Ruti where it's like, this looks awesome. Like, the last fight with her versus this other guy was like, wow, that looked really good. Like, out of nowhere, suddenly the animation just was top-notch. I'm like, where the heck were these animators? So it seemed like everything outside of those two things was, like, very rough. Very rough looking. So, just barely enough to not make it a terrible looking show. So that was kind of a oof for me. Other than that, like, I liked the romance. It was an actual romance. I liked Red and Rit, or Gideon and Rit. They were absolutely cute together. Love that kind of relationship that built. And like I said, was a solid relationship in a fantasy setting, which is very rare. Outside of that, you had, again, the whole Heroes Party stuff, which I thought was interesting, especially Ruti. I think of all the characters, Rudy's story was, I think, the biggest surprise for me. Like, I really didn't think they were going to do anything with the characters. And then out of nowhere, Rudy's character and her development and everything behind her made sense. And it was really cool to get into. Why is this girl an emotionalist doll? There's a reason. Why is she obsessed with Red? There's a reason. Everything has a reason. And it's not very apparent until way late. And then suddenly it's like, oh, crap. That's really cool. Like, you did something really cool with that character. I really liked Rudy's character. Outside of that, yeah, Eris, frustrating as all get. Again, I'll get into that in a minute. the rest of the Heroes Party, I liked the fact that they weren't stupid. Everybody knew Eris did something. Like literally, Yara's like, yeah, I think Eris killed him. I'm not hanging out no more. Donna's like, no, heck no. This dude's somewhere. I'm going to go get him because obviously we're not doing good here. Like, everybody's like, Eris, you're an idiot. You're not fooling nobody, and we need Gideon. So let's get into the crux of my mixed feelings of this show. It's the blessings. And I have to admit, I'm probably thinking way too much into this. But let's be honest, the blessings is, it's the story. Like, everything's around the blessings. And this is the whole Crossange joke. Is if, for those that are not, have not been with us long enough, there was a show called Crossange that we did a review of for a long time ago. And literally we did I don't know how long it was a rant of, but this long review about how we don't know if we like this or not. We hate it. We love it. I don't know. That's the blessings for me, because I don't know if I like it or not, because it's such a cool concept. Like, this is a fantasy setting show. It's pretty set in fantasy. It's not a video game show. This is not an isekai. This is a fantasy setting. But there is one quote-unquote gamey element in the idea that there's blessings in this world that gives people a calling, let's just say. Everybody at some point in their life has a chance of being given a blessing by the deities of this world. And this blessing given to you is kind of a driving force for you. It can be a carpenter. It can be an assassin. It can be a swordsman. It can be a hero. And it's fine. Okay. You're thinking, okay, cool. They have blessings. But it wasn't until like about episode 4 or so, they get into really what that means. They have this kid suddenly shows up to Red and is like, you know, this guy just beat me up kind of thing. This bully. And so we're just thinking, okay, this is this bully character. No, then we get into why he's the way he is, and Red starts explaining, oh, that kid must have the barfighter blessing. What does that mean? Oh, well, it means that he's short-tempered and he wants to fight. And so it's not his fault, he's aggressive because of his blessing. And then they start explaining how they build up their blessing is by, you know, you can do this thing or you can kill other people that have it to make it go faster. And I'm like, holy crap, this is getting, like, dark. but at the same time uncomfortable, because it's essentially establishing in this world, if you have a blessing, it's almost like a driving force. They get really heavy into the idea that it's not just you have this, you can do it or not. They get really heavy into the idea that you're kind of being forced to do it. Like, you have an inner urge to do it. So, again, the bar fighter, he doesn't really want to fight. They get in this whole thing where this kid actually wants to help his village. He wants to be a guard like his brother was. But he has the bar fighter, so it gets him in trouble. But he really wants to protect people. He doesn't want to hurt people. And that gets into other characters. It gets into, again, Rudy being a hero, and it's a driving force for her. She has no choice. It gets into, you know, all these other characters that have this thing as a driving force. And what I quickly realize is that it's a good thing and a bad thing that the writer's doing this, because the good side is this is really interesting. And again, what it does to characters is interesting. But the negative effect of how the story is being built with this idea is it excuses everything. And at that point, I was really struggling. Like, I don't know if I'm going to like this show, because it's literally going to excuse everything with, oh, by the way, it's just a blessing. The champion guy's a jerk. But then Red goes, oh, don't blame him. He's a champion. And champions are typically driven to be better than everybody else. And often that leaves people behind. So don't blame him. He's just a champion. And again, he's going to go further than that with everybody else. Barfighter, you beat a bunch of people. Don't worry. It's just a blessing. You just can't blame him. So, like, okay, now suddenly an assassin's going to show up and kill Rit, and we're going to go, oh, it's because he's an assassin. I mean, it's not his fault. And that was where I really struggled. And then it kind of snowballed from there. I think the moment that they started having, like, this drug that affected the blessings, it was just out of nowhere. And this is my main, like, I can go with everything. Everything is fine. And again, very interesting. I think the point in which I really did fall off the show, enjoyment-wise, it wasn't where Chris was. It was a little bit before then. There was this one episode where they introduced the drug. And from that point on, it felt like the pacing went into the dumpster. Like, literally, it's just shooting forward. Nothing makes sense. It's jumping all over the place. Soldiers are showing up, kidnapping some kid that's apparently involved with something. The question about this incident that doesn't even involve the kid. I don't know why the kid's there, but we're suddenly going to take them there with this other kid to rescue the kid. Then we're talking about the drug. And then suddenly, again, we get into a whole Ares thing, and we get into the whole Rudy stuff. It felt like the pacing went way bad. And I've heard a lot of talk about people saying that they've skipped a lot of content here and rushed a lot of things, which definitely feels like that, because again, like, the moment they brought in that drug to the storyline, it really hit the dumpsters. And the only thing that really fixed the show for me beyond that point, like, if the whole thing with Rudy's development didn't happen, I would have just probably dropped the show. Rudy's development in the later parts of the show was the only thing that saved the show for me, besides the fact that, like I said, I think Red and Rit are cute together, but everything else was like, oof. And again, it goes back to the whole Ares thing. Is he the way he is because, shrug, the blessing? I didn't get the fact that the sage had something like an obsession with serving the hero, but that could have been. So then, shrug. It's just, he's obviously one of getting out of the party because he wants to serve the hero. Shrug, he's not a bad guy. I don't know. It's so mixed. I'm so mixed on this show. I don't know. It's interesting. The blessings was both a blessing and a curse, I guess you can say. Oh, so funny. But yeah, lots of really good animation in Rit. So there you go. If you want to see some really good animation with the blonde-haired girl, there you go. So yeah, banished from the Heroes Party, I decided to live a life in the countryside. I don't know. Moving on. Soccer Gun, did you watch that one?
No.
No? A father-daughter show and you didn't watch it?
I know, right?
I am super shocked. Like, this is, like, literally sweetness and lightning action here.
No.
Anyways.
No, it wasn't.
It was, I was kind of putting it more, it's like, I don't know, Bunny Drop, I guess. Bunny Drop meets Made in Abyss. Yeah, that's about as close as I can get. But anyways.
You put her in Bunny Drop territory at all? I didn't like her that much.
No, I'm not saying the show is on equal standing. I'm just saying the father-daughter thing with Made in Abyss.
Yeah, mom, mother,
it's her, no, it's father, daughter. I can, Made in Abyss either.
I can go with the whole father daughter thing. I got you there. I really, really wanted to like her, but no, this
Are you making fun of Mim and Pooh?
Yes. No, I'm not.
You're mean.
No, you're. I'm.
Anyway,
I didn't like the dad. All right.
Sakugan.
He annoyed
Sakugan.
Me.
Sakugan. Crunchyroll streaming it. Ran for 12 episodes. Done by Studio Satellite. Source is a novel. The genres are sci-fi, mecha, adventure. The director and series composition writer is Junichi Wada, who did World End, Disappearance of Nakatoro Yuki-chan, and Caligula. And this one takes place inside of a colony. Well, there's multiple colonies within a labyrinth. So it seems like everything is kind of taking place underground in this underground area that's called the labyrinth. And within this labyrinth of kaiju and all these cave-ins and all these dangers are these colonies. And these colonies are on these domes, and they're kind of protected from the outside, and all the people live with inside these colonies. There's tons of colonies within this labyrinth. And we take place in one specific colony where we meet Min Min Poo and Gugan Burr, which I hate their names to death, but I'm going to go with it. Hopefully I don't bite my lip trying to say Gugan Burr. For some reason, it's a hard one to say. Anyways, we quickly establish that Min Min Poo really badly wants to leave the colony. She keeps seeing this dream about this big, huge tower out in the middle of this field, and she's just convinced that this tower exists somewhere, and
she
wants
to
find it.
Tokyo Tower?
Neither. But she's desperately wanting to find this tower, and she really wants to leave the labyrinth. But unfortunately, and obviously, Gungan Burr, her father, does not want her to go out in the labyrinth because it's dangerous. There's kaiju and stuff. Well, we come to find out later on that Gungan Burr used to be a marker, which is these people that actually go out into the labyrinth and explore it and go to other colonies and stuff. But at some point, something happens, so he doesn't want to do it anymore, and he doesn't want Min Min Pooh to be a marker either. So he wants to, you know, keep to an easy life of being a driller, which is somebody that just mines in the colony and gets resources underground. So at some point, a kaiju attacks the colony, kind of forces them to kind of fight it, and then they realize, you know, Gungan Burr finally gives in. Like, Min Min Pooh, we went through this whole danger anyways. Min Min Pooh is very dedicated on what she wants to do. Let's go. So he just finally decides to let Min Min Pooh have it. But he says, you know, look, you have to take me with you, and I have to go with you. So they go out into the labyrinth, and they're trying to find this location, this tower. And so along the way, they visit other colonies. They find different people. They end up joining them on their journey. A lot of focus goes around them running into this regulation guy named Mororo. And this guy is like, their group is like a main like government group, but the side thing that kind of gets a lot of focus on with what he's doing is preservation. Like, their whole thing is preservation. So there's obviously issues happening in the labyrinth. There's obviously cave-ins and a lot of maintenance that's not done in certain locations. So he's like trying to preserve the nature and stuff that's within the labyrinth. And there's a lot of focus on this one area that had luscious forests and stuff within it that's, you know, decaying and stuff. So, my thoughts on this series. I think it started out really good. I really loved Min Min Pooh. I loved Gungan Burr. I thought they were really cute together. Really fun little kind of father-daughter thing. Obviously, she thinks she's super smart and she wants to do whatever she wants to do. But obviously, she's too young and he really wants to protect her, even though he's kind of a jerk about it. He's a father. He's really protective of her. And I thought that was going to be the shtick. Like, okay, let's go out on an adventure, Made in Abyss style, go out into the labyrinth where there's dangers, but here's this fun little two-team. They work together, basically, because they have these big robots in this world, and so the two of them pilot together, and they go out to this labyrinth. Well, that was it. Like, after that first episode, which was a really good opening, that was kind of it. Like, they had some really good animation in the first episode, even though they had CGI kaiju and CGI mecha. Everything else was really well animated. A lot of the emotional points were really strong. There was something that really tragic happens early on. I thought it was really a solid opening for the show. And then it just kind of, that was pretty much, that was it. Like, episode 2, didn't work for me. Episode 3, didn't work for me. And I was really struggling. I got, like, 3 or 4 episodes in the show, and then I just kind of, like, I dropped it. Like, I wasn't even thinking about it. And then at some point, I decided to go back. Like, I just ran, like, you know, look, this is a father-daughter story. It's got to be fun. It's got to be something in here. So I finally decided the other day, I'm going to get caught up. I'm going to go back and see if something comes of the show. And it still took a while. Like, it took a while still. Like, I still had to get through all these episodes. And it seemed like it was trying to do a mix between almost like Kino's Journey thing, where obviously every episode would have them either go to some weird labyrinth area, or they would find a colony that they would go into, and the colonies would each have their own little kind of governance inside of it. So one place was all about equality, but then you realize it was all about equality for those that actually became part of the working force, and anybody that wasn't smart enough would end up being kind of discarded to the underground. So each kind of area had its own kind of story behind it. There was one that, like, every family has, like, this one job they do, and their children will do that job. They don't have any other choice. Like, if you're a singer, your children will be singers. If you're a carpenter, your children will be carpenters. Nobody has really a choice outside. So, again, they have almost a Kino's Journey-esque kind of thing where each of these locations has kind of its own thing. Again, struggled. It wasn't until I think the big point in which you start to learn really deeply about what this Miruru guy is doing and the whole preservation stuff. When that happened, suddenly we had this other terrorist group show up. And that's where it got interesting. Like, from that point, I was hooked. And it never let up all the way until the end. So it's like, it's one of those sad things of like, hey, it gets good around episode 8. But here's my thing. Bear with me here. Like I said, I think if you watch the first two episodes and you're sold, please watch the whole thing. You're going to love it. I think if you love the first episode but not the second and third episode, wait until you hear if there's a second season. I think that's where I'm at with this. I think if you watch the first two episodes and you didn't like the second or third episode, wait until you see if there's a sequel. Because the problem I'm having right now is that I really loved where it was going. And I thought that there was so much character development in Gungan Burr and Memenpu. It was so well done. I am so interested to see what they do with these characters going forward. But the problem is the very last episode, at the very end, it's very unknown about what they're doing here. Because on the top left corner of the screen at the last frame, it says to be continued. On the bottom right hand corner of the screen, it says end, and then a big stamp hits the end sign with a not. So that could either mean to be continued, this is the end of it, not, or to be continued, not. So is it saying there's going to be a sequel or not? I think if there's a second season, I'm totally on board, because like I said, I think this story, for me, really picks up. Like, there's at some point where things just really start getting interesting. And I think a lot of that has to do with them finally doing something interesting with Gungan Burr and Memenpu. And really with the world itself, the terrorist group that's obviously after something. All that stuff was really intriguing to me and started to really... It was the first point which we were really kind of starting to put Gungan Burr into, like, a test. And in really doing something with Memenpu. Because the struggle that I had early on with the show was that once you get introduced to these two characters, you're like, okay, cool. This is the genius girl that thinks she can do everything on her own. Here's the overprotective father. But then that's just their character. Like, it's just, how many times do I have to have Memenpu say that she's a genius and that Gungan Burr is a jerk and an idiot, and then Gungan Burr be a father and tell her, no, you can't do this? There was no chemistry there, like I felt. I didn't feel like there was anything going on there besides that one thing.
That was pretty much my main hookup, is I didn't much care for their charisma.
That's exactly where I was sitting. Like I said, introduction, it was fun. Okay, cool. But never really much to do with it. Like, they didn't do anything with it. And they didn't really have it do anything. So, that's where I sit. Like I said, if you watch the first episode, you love it. Then you watch the second episode, you love it. Keep watching it. You're going to love it. If you watch the first episode, love it. Second episode and third episode doesn't work, you might want to wait for a second season. But if you're okay with struggling through it, it gets to some good stuff. It's just it takes a while. Again, and it gets good at 8 or something like that. Somewhere in that third quarter, it just picks up. And I'm really excited to see where it goes. Just, it needs a second season. It really does to have me really sell it.
It sounds like it's going to get one, the way you were describing that, so.
Yeah, it goes two ways. I don't know that they would do like a, okay, it's going to be continued, not. That seems like really bad thing to do, but we'll see. I don't know. But
But yeah, that's Sakugan. It gets good in the third quarter. Moving on, we have Taisho Otome Fairy Tale, or Taisho Otome Otogi Banashi. This one streamed on Funimation, ran for 12 episodes, done by Synergy SP. Sources: a manga. The genres are comedy, drama, romance, slice of life. And the script writer was Hiroko Fukuda, who did Teasing Master Takagi-san Season 2 and will be doing Season 3. So this one takes place in 1921 during the Taisho era, as the title would lead you to believe. And we follow a guy named Tamahiko Shima. And at some point, unfortunately, he's involved in a car accident alongside his mother, where his mother was unfortunately killed. And that makes matters worse. Tamahiko Shima unfortunately lost control or use of his right hand, which is his dominant hand. And being part of this kind of very prestigious family, the Shima family, his father decides to exile him, send him off to the mountains of Chiba, where he's going to live the rest of his life in pretty much seclusion. He's basically dead to the family because having, you know, lost the control of his right hand, he's basically a cripple and he doesn't want to be seen by people and, you know, bring down the Shima family name. So, yeah, now being there, being exiled by his family, seen as dead, they even have this emphasis on the fact that his entire family essentially curses him. They wish that he had died rather than his mother. He's basically in a very dark place now that he's, you know, secluded in this mountainside house, and to the point where he's just going to stay there and just whittle away and die. Well, at some point, a knock comes on the door. He goes to check it, and it ends up being this girl named Mizuki, this 14-year-old girl that has apparently been sent to take care of him. And he kind of recalls back when he was talking to his father that his father was considering sending him somebody to basically take care of him, possibly be his wife, and that is Mizuki. Mizuki is here to be his bride. And so it kind of, he, realizing this, he's like, you know, come in here. He kind of gives his coat to her to warm her up and brings her in, shows her where she can stay. And he pretty much at that point is of the mindset, you know, look, you can just leave because I'm just going to stay here and went away and die. I know my father bought you to send you to me, but, you know, you don't have to stay here. I'm just going to whittle away. There's no point in my existence, basically. But she really kind of jumps to the whole situation. She really kind of starts taking care of him, feeding him, cleaning up the house, kind of serving him as much as she possibly can, to the point where he starts to realize that, you know, this girl is taking a lot of good care of me, and she's kind of a kind-hearted, natured person. And you slowly see the two of them over time build a relationship together. And I guess the other kind of side of this whole coin is that from the perspective of Mizuki being bought basically to sell her parents' debts, she's sold off to the Shima family. She was very uncomfortable with the whole situation. Despite that, she's, you know, doing it because, you know, at that time, you don't really have a choice. But even still, she was going to make it her, you know, purpose that to make basically lemonade out of lemonade or lemonade out of lemons. And the idea that, okay, well, I'm going to go here. I'll do my best, be this person's bride and, you know, take care of him. But it wasn't until she had this insecurity. But the moment that he opens the door and welcomes her in warmly, gives her a coat, she realizes that, you know, like, this person's going to take care of me, and so she does her best to take care of him. And so you see that kind of the two of them, like, warming each other up, basically. Because she came in, he warmed her, she's going to take care of him, warms him, takes him out of his dark place, he wants to warm her. So the two of them are kind of supporting each other as it goes along. Despite this, despite him having this new positive nature in his household, that doesn't really end there, as over time you start to meet other characters, including his sister, who comes in and basically treats him like he's not even there, because obviously nobody lives in this house. Her brother's dead, which kind of pulls him back in that dark nature. At some point, the father really sends a note to say that, you know, he wants to basically declare him as dead because they want the rest of the family to move on. There's so many things from his past keep coming back to haunt him that kind of pulls him back in that darkness. But again, Yuzuki's kind of there to build him back up. So, your thoughts on Taisho Otome Fairy Tale?
I absolutely love this show. This going from the beginning to the end, I Mizuki as a kind of a shining light through this entire series. You really do truly show it really does truly show how much just truly being a, I don't want to say a servant, but somebody who takes the time to just be a genuinely open and loving, kind person, how much that can just honestly break through people's not darkest parts, but it can just being there for somebody and just truly being open to receive, be there for somebody when they really truly need somebody, not necessarily forcing it upon them, just being there for when they want to come to you. And Yuzuki does that in spades. She does that with Tamahiko. She does that with Tamako. She does that with Ryo later on, and some of the other characters. Each character at some point is affected by Yuzuki in some way, shape, or form. And that's one of the things that I truly love about this show, is it's such a breaking down how a person can be changed by another person, and how much that means for that kind of frustration, how you can get stuck inside yourself so much, and just having that person right there ready to go when you're ready, how much that means. And so I love it for that. And that, like I said, that goes through each one of the characters later on. It's actually kind of funny listening to Andrew's review, and he had actually asked me at some point, he had said, "How did you get through the last three episodes?" I don't know. The last three episodes were brutal for me. It really was. There is so many absolutely fantastic character moments through and through this show. I honestly can't sing enough praises about this show. I really, really, truly loved it all the way through.
Yeah, the last three. I'm thankful now, but to start things off, Taisho Tomy Fairy Tale in our preview was my gem of the season. Like I claimed this was going to be the show that nobody's gonna watch, that will be the hidden gem, that show that nobody watches, that we're going, you guys need to watch this show because this does so many things unique. It's a different storytelling, it's a different time period, all these things. This will be that show. I just knew it based on the key art and a little bit of information about the synopsis. I knew this was going to be that gem. And it was funny because when I watched the first episode, I wasn't totally sold, but I was shocked at the same time. It's one of those things where when I watched the first episode, I'm like, okay, this is all right. But I'm not like, oh my gosh, this is super gum or whatever. I'm not going to start screaming at people, they need to watch the show. But it was one of those ones where every time I tried to throw a trope at it, it wouldn't take it. Like, I'm like, okay, this girl's like way too positive. She's got to be like a childhood friend that she's forgotten about, that she's, I've always wanted to marry Tamahiko or something like that. No, you're getting the story from the beginning. Like, this is the moment she knocks on that door. That's their first meeting. And I was shocked by that. I'm like, okay, this is interesting. And then I'm like, why is she so positive? It's got to be something. She's got to be a ditz. Maybe she's a ditz. And then at some point it shows you her perspective where she's like, she's at school and she's talking to her friends. She's like, They're such good friends. And everybody's like, oh, man, you're going to be a great wife one day. And she's like, yeah, this is going to be great. And then one day she's like, I'm sorry, I got to go. She's never going to see them again because she's being sold off. Her family has sold her off. And again, this is a thing of its time. This is something that happens. And it's so tragic to really think of how that is disconnecting for her. Like, you've given up everything. Like, she even says at some point she told her parents, don't worry about it, but just go on with your life as if I had died. Because she never thought she'd ever see her family again. There's no reason that she would. She's been sold. Her entire existence is no longer there. She's no longer Yuzuki, basically. And the show, that insecurity she has, getting in the car, going to this place, knocking on this door, not knowing who's behind the door. All she knows about this guy is that her father bought her. And then the moment that he opens the door and, again, put something over her to warm her because she's walked all the way to this house, gives her that warmth, gives her a place to stay. She realizes, I'm safe. Like, this isn't a bad person. I can do this. And that's her driving force, is I'm going to make this happen. I'm going to be that wife that I'm supposed to be. And it's not a bad thing. She is positive in her nature, And she realizes very quickly over time that this person isn't a bad person and she's got a place to stay. And it's that security and that difference in what I was imagining it was going to be that I'm like, oh, good. This is not playing in any kind of tropes. She has insecurity. Did she ever say what the second insecurity was? I don't think she ever did. I just realized that.
Between her hair and her chest?
She said hair. Was it the chest? I guess that would have been it. I don't think she ever actually said it, but that was a good reveal. She's back in heat.
that was one of those things. It was like
she's in trouble. Something's wrong. Let me take this off. Okay.
Yeah, it's one of those things that it's really kind of funny because they play her off as a lolly so much, and then suddenly that scene, it was like, oh, okay.
Well, that was the other nice thing is that they do establish really quickly that this girl's 14 years old. He's 17. But she's really quick to saying, look, I'm not 15 yet. 15 is the age of consent at that time period in that area. So it's like they do respect that. It's not as if it's going into that whole thing. It's they establish really quickly and they respect it. But it's just it was so shocking of how this show could have fell into so many things. And it could have done so many things that frustrated me. There was probably only one point that frustrated me, and they had one point where it was like, just tell her what's going on. Why do we have to do this whole thing? We don't say what's going on. It's going to blow up in your... Yeah, there it goes. It blows up in your face because you didn't say anything. You could have said something. They only did that once. But other than that, it never really plays off of tropes or anything like that. I mean, the only trope that I would probably say is the idol gets involved at some point. It just so happens they get to know the idol. Other than that, everything really kind of plays in its own story at its own pace, and it tells such a really fantastic story. This is, again, a relationship building from the ground up, and as a relationship that was really well told. Couple that with the fact that this is that thing that you say, hey, Andrew, what is the thing that you love a lot of is those time period snapshots. Like, this is this time period. That Taisha era, this 1920s era, that is completely unique to me, or at least a unique story kind of time frame to get into. It's not modern times, romance, or anything like that. This is a snapshot of a time period that I was really into. And I think they really pulled off the era, just the styling of everything, the clothing, everything looked really beautiful and really well done. The difficulties of that time period is obviously there. I mean, we can probably make an argument that probably whatever's wrong with his hand could probably be easily fixed these days, but those days it was debilitating and it was a death sentence. Those days, something like that, if you're part of a big family, the idea of being a cripple or somebody with some sort of disability is just not acceptable. You're dead to the family at that point. And it's so sad as that being a death sentence is just so, so wrong. The ability for the writer to really kind of bring in characters that have, like, at face value seem like rotten people, but you realize they have their own baggage and their own insecurities they get into. The sister was a prime example of that. Ryo can die in a fire. I don't care. They tried to make me like her. I still don't like her. But, like, it even got to the point where they introduced a character late in the show, and I was like, oh, please don't be another nasty person with baggage. No, they didn't do that. Okay, cool. Thank you. The writer's not just always going to rely on that. They know how to write characters in different ways. There was so many great characters in the show besides Ryo, she can die in a fire. They were all fantastic.
She wasn't that bad.
Yeah, she was. She was rotten.
She had a bad intro.
Don't even go there. Don't say because her father. No.
You know, I actually kind of forgot about the dad, but yeah, I hated the dad. No. I hated the dad.
Yeah.
But no, I'm not.
The apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
This is the frustrating thing because there was a specific scene that if Andrew will only point and he's pointing at this one scene, and I agree, I hated her in that particular scene.
Because she had a chance to let up and she never does. That's my frustration.
I warmed up to her a little bit more afterwards. That's fine. But that scene was heartbreaking. This is like I said earlier, there's some fantastic character moments. And hers is one of the strongest outside of the latter three episodes, which was a lot of massive character moments. But this this particular scene was probably one of the strongest character moments, especially between Tamahiko and Yuzuki. There, it all revolves around one particular object, and she was the kind of the catalyst antagonist for that moment. And I will agree, I did not have a lot of love for Ryo at that moment. But yeah, latter moments, I kind of more chilled out on her and eventually warmed up to her. But yeah, so when it comes down to it, she wasn't that bad.
Too bad.
She just, I hated her at that moment.
Yeah, we're gonna agree to disagree with that one. I hate saying that statement, but we'll agree to disagree with that one. I only accept her
every
because
character
wants
deserves
to.
Redemption.
No. I was waiting
Except
for the
for
father.
Daddy.
I was,
Except for
I was
daddy.
Waiting for the father. I was really
you know,
waiting.
You know that when they continue this show, that's going to happen. They're going to try to redeem the daddy.
You
know, and
and that's the whole thing. It's like, that's the perspective I got early on with the show. Like, the moment that they really did something with the sister, I'm like, I actually thought this in the first episode. From the first episode, I thought to myself, with all the perspective of everybody looking at him with such distaste, detested him, they wanted him dead. I was like, I just know every single one, there's going to be a story behind this. It's going to be all in his head. That's what my perspective was, that it was going to be in his head, that he thinks they're saying that. And I am really waiting for that moment that they really get into that, because obviously his father hasn't really deemed him, like, He's sent his son off, which is really terrible. He has sent a letter to Tamahiko saying, we're going to deem you as dead because the rest of the family wants to move on. And he wants to marry off some of the children, and they can't have him be alive because they're going to have weddings, and then people are going to expect him to bring his son to the wedding. Otherwise, it would be disrespectful. So the idea is that he has to deem his son as dead so that there's no expectations for people in the now to expect that he brings his son into the picture. So it makes sense. And I think that's where it's going to get into that stuff, is the idea that he could have basically had his child killed, honestly. He could have just sent him off to the gallows. He could have sent him off to Chiba and not support him there. But he's still supporting him because his mindset is that a Shima family has to always support their children. And so he's still going to financially support his child, despite the fact that he's deeming him dead. So he is taking care of him. He's just trying for the best for that, and that's what it's going to turn into.
He's always thinking
for the best for his children, and he can't have Tamahiko around for the best of his children. So this is what he thinks he has to do to secure their futures. It's going to be that.
And did you catch that Tamahiko was more along the lines of she thought that was the humor?
She thought that was the humor.
Yeah, she thought it was a humor. I don't want to dig into it too much, but she was relaying. She was trying to lay into dark humor with him.
She was laughing about the fact that they were all crying at his funeral.
Right. She was trying to poke into the dark humor. She didn't realize it was affecting him. And it wasn't that she hated him. It was just that she was trying to relate to him with the dark humor.
Yeah, she's dealt with crap too. The family, the Shima family name is another thing for the synopsis of the story. The Shima family name is not good. Everybody really does see them as bad people. And it's probably partially to do with you know, people being jealous of the money they have. But the fact that the Shima family controls a lot of things with money and power, that people don't look at them fondly.
No.
So when Tamahiko comes in town, nobody likes him. Like, oh, that's the guy that bought his wife. That they really look down on him. Even to the point where when he's trying to help, they don't want him to get involved. It's rough what he's going through. And it goes to your point that I think a huge part of the story is about this idea of sometimes when somebody's in their darkest place, all they need is somebody that just took care. Somebody just needs to be there and comfort. That's all they need to do. They don't even have to, you know, say, I understand your woes. They don't have to, you know, prod and pick on trying to figure out what's wrong with you so they can fix it. Just be there. And that was what Yuzuki was just being there. It's all he needed. Somebody to give him a reason. He just needed a reason. And I like how that eventually becomes a key pivotal point of his story. And technically the romance is that realization that I need to take care of this person. I need to stop having her do everything and essentially using her. Not like he's saying, Yuzuki, go clean this. Is that the idea that he's not He's not being the other side of it. He's not being the
reciprocating.
No, it's not when she's lifting up this side of the board, you need to lift up the other side to be, make it balance. You can't just let her support everything. You have to pick up the other pillar so that you guys can hold the thing up together. And he's not doing that part. He's just allowing her to pick it up until the board falls off, essentially. It's not so much about reciprocation, because it's not necessarily he needs to accept it. It's just a, you need to not, you don't allow her to do everything, essentially. You need to do your part and support her as well. And he eventually gets to that point. And I think that's like the, that's how good the romance is in the show, is that it's not forced. It's not like she's like super lovey-dotey to him until he eventually realizes, oh my gosh, she actually likes me. I guess I do like her. It's not that he's like, holy crap, now I have this hot girl here, and oh, now I realize that she's got, you know, ballistics too. I really like this girl. Oh my gosh, doki doki.
That's true.
It's really a slowly blossoming, I don't want to say a codependence thing. It's a naturally occurring thing through just, again, that cross warmth. One side warms the other one warms them, and they just keep warming each other until they realize that, I guess, codependency. there's a mutual thing there, and I love that. And it's so much more than I really was anticipating early on, and I really do like that. Again, couple that in with the time period, how well they executed that. It looked good. It wasn't like they're going for something crazy here, but it looked visually pleasing. They had a lot of cool artistic choices here. And in the end, it was, yes, again, like Chris brought up, gets really heavy later on. And it's a sign of great writing and great characters when you get so invested. I tweeted after I finished the last episode, like, I waited until the last episode because I didn't want to say anything while I was getting into it, and then somebody spoiled something. I was like, I feel so bad for anybody that was watching this on a weekly basis, because I think from like late episode nine, I think, or something like that, it doesn't let up. It feels so heavy with what they're getting into, and I'm like, I don't know where this is going, and I'm really upset. And I need the next episode. And I binged it. Like, I went all the way. Like, I was starting late at night, and I just kept watching until it was over, because I'm like, I cannot not finish this now. So good. It was such a good show. Great characters. Great drama. Like I said, it's not melodramatic, which I don't like melodramatic stuff. It's just got a nice, solid balance of drama. Just so many good points in the show. So it's an anime of the year contender for me. That's for sure.
Yeah,
this is, besides Mushoku Tensei, I think this is probably the best show of the season. I think it beat Muroko-chan, which I didn't think anything would beat Muroko-chan. 86. No, I don't know. That's going to be a tough one. This is going to be a tough season to do because of it's going to that conundrum again of what they're doing different things. It's going to be tough. It's going to be real tough. It's going to be blood. It's going to be a blood sport for the Deliberations podcast. It's good. I highly recommend it. I'm so happy it turned out as good as it did. But yeah, Taisho Tomy Fairy Tale Selection Project. So next one, Funimation streamed it, ran for 13 episodes, done by Studio Dogokobo. The source was a multimedia project. The genres are music, slice of life. And the director was Daisuke Hiramaki, who did Wataten, Asteroid and Love, a lot of titles for PA Works as well. The character designs was done by Kana Hirayama, who did Rent-A-Girlfriend's character designs, so definitely familiar there. But yeah, this one opens up with a girl named Suzune. And Suzune, early on, it's kind of established that she's been in hospital for a lot of her childhood. She has some sort of issue, and it isn't until at some point she gets a surgery, and then she's able to recover. The entire time, she was kind of helped getting through that kind of tough period of her life because she was always watching an idol named Akari. And Akari was this girl that was the first time winner of a idol show called Selection Project, as the title would lead you to believe. But unfortunately, at some point, Akari passed away. But then jump forward, Suzune has recovered fully. She had a really good surgery. She was able to recover, and now she's able to kind of move around again. She's regained her health, and she quickly wants to go and do the dream that she's always had. She's always watched Akari, this idol. She loved her music, and she always dreamed of that one day she'd be healthy enough that she can become an idol and follow in the footsteps of Akari. So now she's going to obviously try out for the selection project. So she goes into the district tryouts for the selection project and fails miserably. She unfortunately has a kind of a relapse of her weakness and fails. But then due to circumstances, she ends up being selected anyways, and she gets brought into the selection project, along with 8 other girls. And what the selection project really does is they bring all these girls into this one place, and they each compete against each other for what they call yells, which are technically likes. So they'll live stream it, and then they'll perform, and then everybody will give yells. Each individual person can vote once, and the girls kind of accumulate those yells, and they can either, you know, pass that particular round or fail. Well, they start doing this whole thing. They live together in this one place. They live stream a lot of little segments of them talking, and eventually they'll have a competition where they compete for yells, and then if they get them or not, they lose or not. And this kind of continues on. You kind of slowly meet each of these girls. Obviously, each of them have their own little quirks. You have the girl who likes to eat a lot. She's a country bumpkin. You have the childhood star that used to star in this detective show. You have the athletic girl. You have the very rich Ojo girl. You have the motherly type girl. Each of them have their own little kind of archetypes. Oh, yeah, you also have the long black-haired snotty girl that thinks everything's about being rivals and that nobody should be friends. That one, too. They always have to have that one in idol shows, of course. But anyways, they all kind of meet each other. It kind of unfortunate, I guess. Did you watch the show?
Well, to give you a hint, as you were scrolling down, I said, what the heck is that? So, okay, probably so not.
The Sumi Panda?
Yeah.
Sumi Panda?
Sumi Panda.
Sumi Panda is the host. But yeah, I guess to start kind of diving into my thoughts as I kind of go along with this whole process is...
He has 4 eyes, just in case anybody is wondering.
No, he's only got 2 eyes. It's just he's got a suit on. Yeah. So it looks like he has 4 eyes. Anyway,
he has eyes in his mouth.
The struggle that I quickly have is that it kind of established this idea of reality TV show. Obviously, they're all rivals. And it kind of gave the sense that this is all going to be about each of these girls competing against each other. But what it quickly does, it decides, okay, now everybody group up. So we make basically idol groups. So it kind of throws that out the window really quickly. But what it does with that is interesting. Because the struggle that I kind of have with a lot of these shows where they have a huge cast is... episode per character. Like, okay, now it's time for the country bumpkin girl, time to get into her story, give an entire episode to it. And then you end up realizing that you only have 3 episodes to work with because you just spend an episode to work on each character. But I like how this story does it, because what it does is it technically groups these girls up in these little groups to compete against the other ones. And how what that does good is that you essentially develop the characters and get into them in groups. So like for one example, one of the groups had both Hiromi and Nagisa. And you kind of get in this whole thing with them really struggling about a similar issue. And again, it's good to have that because you don't have to worry about both Hiromi having an episode and Nagisa having an episode. They develop together. That equally happens with other characters. I think one of the nice ones was specifically Mako and how she's like the motherly character. And so when these other two kind of have an argument, she comes in and kind of treats them like the motherly character and, you know, reprimands them. And so you get that development that she has a family that has a ton of siblings. And so that's why she's more motherly, because she's basically raised a lot of siblings. So again, I both kind of struggle with the fact that they kind of ditched the idea of, you know, full-on competition really quickly, but it helps develop the characters. Not significant amounts, but it was enough that I kind of grew to like each of these characters more than just their archetypes.
I freaking love the character artwork. That's for fact.
Yeah. And Dokkaba did a pretty solid job of keeping them on model and looking good. There was a couple points where it kind of slips away, but it overall, it looked really good most of the time. So that's where we get into my next struggle, is... despite the fact that it really kind of hitting on this idea of these, you know, they're going to do a competition, and this competition, usually half the show gets lost because it's a really hard part of the competition. Nobody gets kicked out. And at some point you're realizing, is anybody going to actually get voted out of this show? It feels like it kind of sets up all this stuff, but then it keeps throwing them out the window and becoming a typical idol show. And that was my big struggle about halfway through the show. And then the big issue comes along. Yes, the big controversy that Selection Project faced. Did you hear about this?
Only what you were frustrated with it about.
Oh, okay. I don't know if that's it or not. But yes, the fact that this has a core story in it that's very, very similar to a show, another show that was early this year or early 2021.
Everything that you've described has made it sound like that. So yeah, I'm going to...
I Dolly Pride. It was very... It had a core story element that was very, very similar to I Dolly Pride. Now, I admit it was kind of a not a struggle, but it was a little bit of like a sigh, like, oh crap, we're actually going to do this. It's so much similar to I Dolly Pride. But thankfully,
no, there was a whole bunch in what you've just described from the because Idly Pride had had the whole system that was the whole reason why he brought the entire group together, because he wanted to, was it a Venus the Venus Project or something like that?
Yeah, it was an AI system. Yeah, that
sounds like the almost to a T, not exactly, because the yells are people voting for it, but basically you're using a system to get a...
Well, every idol show has people being voted on to be the winners of... I mean, that's School Idol Project. School Idol Project is literally that. So
my point is that a lot of... If you had just changed a couple of words out, you almost would have had exactly Idly Pride to a T. You were almost describing the exact same thing.
I won't agree there, but yes, like I said, the core story is definitely very similar. And like I said, I had a sigh moment with it, and I was kind of grumbling about it, but at the same time, I was like, okay, that's fine. We deal with this a lot with things like, you know, isekais. So what are you going to do with it, show? And thankfully, it does a lot more with it. And the best way that I can describe this for people that have watched Idly Pride and haven't watched Selection Project yet, it's one of those things where if you watch one or the other, you're not going to care. So if you've never watched Idly Pride, you're not going to care. But I think for people that have watched Idly Pride, what I would tell you is that what Idly Pride does well is the past. Mana's story was fantastic. The past elements was fantastic. And so much focus was on Mana's legacy. Whereas this one I feel is so much more focused on the now and the future because of that circumstance. And so the driving force and the nugget of, you know, good storytelling here is how it changes the characters and what they do in the future, not so much the past. And so that's where I'll kind of leave it. And I really love what they end up doing with that. I think the developments that happen and specifically the two characters involved in that core element was really well done. And it felt a lot less... Obviously, Idly Pride had a ghost in it. This felt like it made more logical sense. It's more grounded in reality, and it makes sense for how it unfolds. And I do like how it unfolded that. And I, like I said, I really loved the character developments that happen in the characters based on that core story. But not just that, but that's literally the halfway through the show. There's so much more stuff that it gets into beyond that. It's not just that being the punchline. And the stuff that it actually gets into in the later half of the show actually surprised me. I really wasn't expecting the story to go in the direction that it did. And it gave so much more credit. It allowed me to give a lot more credit to the characters themselves. It's one of those things where, again, they did establish most of these characters through their groups and the struggles they each individually face that developed them. But what it does is the later parts of it really kind of strips them of a lot of their opportunities. It allows them to start from the ground up. And I think that made them grow so much more than it just being about the Selection Project, I guess. And I really loved where they end up going with the characters. It had so many great emotional points in the later part. It felt like a true underdog story in the end. And I really did love that. And so I'm going back to Sakugan. Where it's like, I don't think the earlier segments were all that great. And I did struggle with that core story being very similar to Idly Pride. But in the end, the story did some really good stuff. And it kind of cemented itself as one of my favorite idol shows in the end, despite it having a very rough first half. it's like the first half is only rough because I was expecting something that was sold to me and it did nothing with it. The whole reality TV show did nothing with it. The whole rivalries between all of them in competition, it didn't do nothing with it. It was all, it felt like everything in the first half were just fake threats, really, is what it is. So much of the development, so much of the characters was so much in the second half. So it took a while, but it definitely turned around for me. This is, again, similar to Sakugan, where I'm really happy that I went back to watch it, just because it did actually end up doing something solid in the end. So, if any of that's coherent to anybody, I hope I explained it well enough. Check out Selection Project, but yeah, there you go. Oh yeah, by the way, I almost forgot. The music is phenomenal. I love the music. Like Rena and Suzume's song is so good. Like it is such a good song. I've listened to it so many times. It's something like Butterfly Bye or something like that. It's BB. It's such a good song. The ED song, which is the main song that Akari wrote, which is Only One Yell. Such a good song. So catchy. It's such an earworm. I love it to death. The ED has each of the characters sing that song in their own way. But obviously, Akari's probably going to be the one that most people really like, because Akari, again, is voiced by the same seiyuu that did Sakurai. So hearing her sing that song is like super good. Such a good music. Like all this music's good. Like one of the pairings that the girls have is they make a band. And because what essentially is when they separate the groups, the characters in the groups, they each pick like this one paddle and it makes them do something specific. So this group ended up doing instruments and this group ended up doing, I think, dance routine. This one did vocals. And so each one of them did their own style. And so like even the one with like the instruments, like does this little kind of rock thing. Really good music there. Again, Suzune and Rina's song being the vocal group was a phenomenal song. And even with the other group with the dance routine was a great song as well. They just good music overall. I don't think there was really any music that I didn't enjoy. The CGI they use for the dance routines, it's unfortunate. It seems to be a common thing. It has the same, I'm in the same boat as something like Idolly Pride, where it's like, it's fine, it works, it's pretty well polished, but at the same time, in certain lighting, it's kind of more obvious. But even still, the stage performance themselves look really good, despite them being CGI. Like, just the effects, the camera work and everything with the song itself just worked out well. So, great, great music, great, great performances. So glad I forgot. I almost forgot to mention that. The Way of the House Husband, this one should probably decently quick. It's only 5 short episodes for part 2. But yeah, Goku Shufu Do, which streamed on Netflix, ran for again for 5 episodes, done by JC Staff. Comedy romance slice of life. For those who don't know, this essentially follows Kendra Suda. No, it follows a guy named Tatsu. And Tatsu is like this guy that used to be a part of the Yakuza, and he was known as like the immortal Tatsu or dragon. And he was just like this very well-known evil criminal guy, and at some point he decides to quit his life as being part of this gang and marry this girl named Miku. And so the two of them are living together. She works and he is a house husband, obviously, like the title leads you to believe. So it's kind of the whole shtick and the joke of this whole thing is just having this guy that's very scary looking. He looks like a rough Yakuza guy, but he's trying to be a good husband. And so often the jokes are kind of based around the idea of people kind of misinterpreting him as being malicious, but he's not really being malicious. He's just trying to be, again, a good husband. Learns how to cook really well, take care of things, and it's just doing the same stuff that kind of got with the first part of the Way of the House Husband. It's still really, really funny. Kendra Suda voices the main character. Literally, they created a dialect that Kendra Suda does for this character. He is this character. Enough that he does a live action version of The Way of the House Husband, and he acts as a character. He is the embodiment of this character, and he really carries the show because it never changed. I guess that's really my review, is it nothing has changed from the first part to the second part. JC Staff, I don't know what the hell is in your mind. It doesn't look good. Visually does not look good. It is literally sliding stills. There's no effort whatsoever put into the animation of the show. Kendra Suda literally carries a show with his voicing and how he basically plays the voicing role for this character. Had some really funny moments in this one. I really love the him taking care of this one dog for this people and him going out in the streets and having like this almost like these two gangs are going to clash, but then they didn't just basically doting over the dogs. That kind of stuff is always fun. The guy that's his neighbor that's nearly burnt down the apartments, he wants to barbecue because he's a foreigner, so they basically fight against the cops to barbecue something because they're not allowed to. They did a lot more with Miku than they in this season than the, or the, this part than they did with the first part, and that was kind of nice. They didn't really get too much Miku in the first season. She was always working. But in the second part, they play a lot off on her and her obsession with the Polycure? I think it was Polycure. This magical girl that she kind of geeks out about, and she has like this whole dream sequence where she's a magical girl and reprimands some guy for not allowing her to do her transformation properly. It's a lot of fun. That's always kind of my struggle with the series. And it was my struggle with the first part, my struggle with the second part. I absolutely love the concept of the show. I love Kendro Suda. Kendro Suda, again, embodies this character. And it just sucks that it's so poorly adapted. I joke with the first part. It literally feels like somebody just scanned the manga panels into a computer, colored them in, and then slid them across the screen using PowerPoint. It's that bad and that kind of offensive. So it sucks. I hope one day they go back and just readapt this whole thing with a different studio that wanted to give it care. I understand there's probably... I want to say that I read somewhere where somebody said that this was how they wanted it adapted. I don't understand why anybody would be okay with that. If somebody involved with this said that this is how they wanted it adapted, they're probably saying that because in Japan you don't burn bridges. And if they didn't like it, they would have said they liked it. So it sucks. But anyways, it's short. It's not a big investment. And like I said, I really love Kendro Suda, and it's so funny just hearing him voice that character. He's so good at it. But yeah, Way of the House Husband Part 2. Check that out if that's interesting to you. Irina the Vampire Cosmonaut, or Suki to Laika to Nosferatu, or loosely translated as Moon, Laika, and the Bloodsucking Princess. Streaming on Funimation, ran for 12 episodes. The studio is Arvo Animation. The source is a light novel, and the genres are vampire and space. And this one takes place in an alternative history. 1945 is when it starts. This is following the First World War. And again, like I said, it's an alternate history. I mean, obviously, because of the fact that there's vampires in it. Unless you think there's vampires in this world, which, good on you. But anyways, following World War I, essentially the world is divided into two superpowers. One to the west and one to the east. And the interesting thing about this is, being an alternate history, things play out slightly different in the idea that in this alternate history, after essentially the two sides, the two superpowers have pretty much, you know, laid claim to all land they want to lay claim to, or they can lay claim to, they decide to go to space. And so this turns into the space race. And so the east and the west are racing to go to space. And again, interestingly enough, with this world, the east is doing an incredible job and the west is failing miserably. In the east, they quickly launch satellites, they get a dog into orbit, all that kind of stuff, all the way into the current time that we're following the story, in that they have decided they want to be the first nation to send a human to space. And how they're going to do that is that they want to test it out first by using something similar to a human, which is a vampire. Even though in this world, everybody kind of sees vampires being like a lesser being. They're lesser than human. They're equal to dogs, basically. They feel that they're close enough to humans that they can send them into space in order to test humans, because hypocrisy. So they decide to basically capture this vampire named Irina, bring her to this base, and have this... he was going to get kicked out of the Space Academy, Lev Leps, to essentially train her to become a cosmonaut. We find out that Lev Leps, he was one of the candidates to becoming the first pilot to space, but unfortunately he decided to step in when a commander was beating the crap out of somebody, and he got himself in trouble. So he's about to be kicked out, but they decided, since he's knowledgeable about cosmonaut, you know, being a pilot, we'll put him in position to take care of this vampire to train her. So it's interesting enough because the society, like I said before, sees vampires as lesser than humans, but Lev isn't kind of, he's different in the idea that he doesn't really see that. So when he meets Irina, he's like, oh no, hey, what's your name? And she's kind of shocked because most humans treat them like dirt. I mean, on a regular basis, it seems like people go out and just mass massacre all vampires. I mean, burning down entire villages of vampires. Irina's parents were burned alive in front of her by just some random military group coming in and purging them. So she takes a bit to kind of allow his positive nature to kind of rub off on her, but the two of them over time kind of work together, like I said, training her to be a cosmonaut to eventually send her off to, again, pave the way for the first human to go to space. You quickly get an idea, too, that's obviously similar to most nations like this. Propaganda exists, so they quickly establish the idea that, oh yeah, by the way, that first dog that went to space, it didn't make it back. Propaganda happened, so they wanted this the world to know that this dog went to space and came back alive, but no, he fried up there. He's no longer with us. But again, society does not know that because propaganda. They want the world to know that they're succeeding. So there is a fear there and the idea that, you know, obviously Irina being sent to space, they don't want nobody to know that because they don't want a vampire to be the first person to space. So there is a big question mark. It's the idea of, well, what will happen to Irina when she gets back? Are they just going to, you know, kill her and cut her open and figure out what happened to her when she was up in space? A lot of question marks as to her safety. Even if she survives based on his training, will she survive when she gets back? And there's a lot of question marks there. So your thoughts? Oh, thank God. I thought you were going to say I didn't get this. I was going to kick you when the dog's in the way.
I really, for the most part, I very much enjoyed myself watching the show. There's a lot of great character moments in the show. Irina and her
eating style
and her her growth as a character through the story, going from pretty much cold and indifferent, goal oriented to get to her goal, which was to be the first one in space.
To get to the moon before mankind tarnishes it. Let's be clear.
That being her goal that she wanted to get to at some point, drove her through a lot of the quote-unquote garbage that a lot of humans were putting her through. Lev, his growth was kind of hit and miss because it was very subtle through a lot of it, mostly because he came into the story at a certain point and nothing outside of caring for Irina really gave him much of a purpose. So to get through a lot of this, it really was hinged on how much you like Irina. Lev, at some point in the latter episodes, you start to see where the conflicts surrounding Irina start to cause more problems, and then he starts to find his place in both protecting Irina and at the same time try and find his way into where what he wanted to do and his goals. And so it does have a lot of interesting interplays in each one of the characters as the story progresses. So when it all comes down after I've finished the entire thing, I did walk away very much enjoying what I watched with this show. So yeah, I can definitely suggest it. There's a lot of really great character moments. So yeah, definitely liked it.
I think a lot of people that are like super history buffs are probably going to love this because it obviously does have a lot of, again, alternative history, but a lot of reference to actual real life events and groups and stuff like that. You can obviously draw comparisons to a lot of these groups. And it is kind of funny to see this kind of different take on, again, technically adding vampires in the mix, but this different layout of how history plays out and how each side really does go into the space race. As it went along, I'm not a huge history buff, but at the same time, I did find some, you know, things here and there that I did kind of find intriguing. I mean, for one example, the area that they're in, which is the Laika base, is technically a reference to an actual space dog. That kind of stuff is really cool to realize. So I think if you're a history buff, you're going to probably find a lot of the enjoyment out of that. Outside of that,
my joke is that I came for the vampire waifu and I stayed for the really solid drama and romance that it actually has in it. In a lot of the earlier parts are kind of, yes, I kind of agree with Chris on the idea that Lev doesn't, he feels like too good of a person, kind of to a fault or a to unbelievable factors. But at the same time, he's a good-natured person that you do kind of support. And I do like him being existent in the situation because everybody treats Irina like garbage. And so having him there is really solid, despite the fact that he, in a lot of cases, lacks the power to be able to protect her. But I think that's really where a lot of my enjoyment later on in the series comes from, is that establishment at some point that there's so much unknown for the future of this these two that it sucks. Like, you feel the powerlessness that the characters have as it goes along. I mean, one of the key points that really got me was that realization at some point that no matter what he does to prepare her, she's still dead. And that realization of that factor sucks. Like, okay, so you taught her how to parachute properly so that when she comes back into the atmosphere and she, you know, ejects from her capsule, she's going to be safe and she can land on the ground. But what does it matter? I mean, there's a possibility they'll walk up to her and shoot her dead on the spot. There's a factor that if she goes too far out of the border of the lands into enemy territory, they will detonate the TNT inside there because they don't want her to, anybody to know that they sent a vampire to space. The propaganda is fearful, and they get into that kind of stuff. They get into the parties that basically keep everybody in check and keep people to the positivity of the nation itself. The propaganda, again, is there. And I think that how they set that stuff up is, it's hit and miss, but at the same time, it's enough that I really did establish at some point, I don't know where this story could go. I don't know if it's going to get dark. I don't know if there is a future for these characters. And your heart kind of breaks because you realize at some point, you kind of start to like these characters and you want to see them happy. You want to see Irina happy. You want to see Lev take care of Irina. But at the same time, you realize the powerlessness that's there. And that's really where it gets me to, I think, the how well this story executes its end. Because again, there's so much unknown about how this story can end. And it feels like basically the immovable object. How do you get past the immovable object that it kind of set up? And I think this show, in my opinion, knocked it out of the park. I loved how this show ended and how it executed that in a way that I believed. Like, I understood how this could happen, and the writer pulled it off. Like, you've set up these cards to play out this way. How can you end this in a way that I'm going to be satisfied? And it did it. It pulled it off. And it did it in spades. And I really do respect the writer for that, because it was, again, from about the halfway point, I really didn't know what this writer was going to do with the story. I didn't know how they were going to pull this off. And having so many great points leading up to that as well was fantastic. I loved a lot of the scenes and how they, without spoiling things, I loved how that first launch happened, how things played out, and how they reference it later on, I guess is the best way they can put it.
I agree.
They pulled off a lot of that stuff, and I really did like that. Lev and Leps were fantastic. Lev and Irina were fantastic. Anya was best girl. Super horizontal headbutt and all. a lot of the side characters. I think if you wanted to pull one negative out me, I'd probably say it was the other candidates. I think Rosa and what was the other guy's name? Mitchell, I think his name. Rosa and Mitchell, I joked about this in one of my impressions. I don't feel like this writer likes to write character-to-character conflicts. Because how they played out, how they resolved Rosa's story, and how they resolved the other guy's story, I forget what his name is again, I think it's Mitchell or something like that. They were kind of like one of those scene change character comes up and they're like, eh, everything's fine now. It's like, what? Like, okay. Like, they were, the resolutions in their stories were like, okay, we got to that conclusion, sure, whatever, move on. I don't know. I just felt like both of those characters were so weakly concluded. I understood Rosa's conclusion. The other guy I didn't understand at all. But they just felt so anticlimactic. Like, I don't know where it's like, okay, I guess we're just moving on from that. All right, cool, whatever. Back to Lev and the internet. I don't care. Those were probably the only two weak parts.
The other part was that I don't think the story... And again, how do I properly say this without spoiling it? There's two key characters in the last bit of the show that make them... They make a move. And while they... It's not unexpected that they make that move, but I don't think the writer or the adaptation properly explained why in the end. I understand them doing it, but I don't fully understand why they would do it and to the extent they did it. And so I don't know if that's something that, again, the adaptation just skipped, or maybe they'll get into it in the future, because they kind of were about to get into it, but they left it very vague at the end. So it doesn't bother me, though. I just felt like I kind of wanted to know more about that. But in the end, I was, again, like I said, very happy with how the writer really kind of wrapped things up. So, and it didn't feel source material bait too, and I was really surprised by that. I think it was a really solid chapter close. They do kind of jump around the world and show a couple very obviously unique looking characters that will probably be later in the light novel, but I didn't care. I think it was a really solid conclusion. Even if I would love more, but even if I don't, I wouldn't be upset. So, I really loved it. You're another vampire cosmonaut. Rumble Garundal or Gyokuten Sekai no Denshi Shoujo or World Twisting Battery Girls. Oh, this one's a fantastic one. Streamed on Funimation, ran for 12 episodes, done by Studio Lurch. The source is an original. The genres are action, comedy, mecha, sci-fi. The character designer behind this one was Akio Watanabe, who obviously did the Monogatari series, Higurashi Nu and Etotama. So fantastic character designs. The director was Masaomi Ando, who did School Live, Astro Lost in Space, Scum's Wish, and Hakutomi Tomikuchi. And the series composition by Makoto Uezu, who did Scum's Wish, Assassination Classroom, Konosuba, and Carnival Phantasm. And this one essentially takes place in Japan, kind of a different Japan. The idea that essentially in the past, at some point, a rift opened up to a parallel world, which was kind of a world similar to our world, I guess. And all these military groups surged through it and quickly took over Japan because they had these specialized mechas that, you know, mankind couldn't fight against. And they essentially took over Japan. And their whole thing was to basically rule by an iron thumb, that everybody was going to be a cog in the system, and that anything entertainment-wise, otaku nature, basically, is not allowed. So any kind of pastimes you have or hobbies or video games, all that kind of stuff, ain't going to happen. Can't have it here. And so they basically abolish all that stuff. We quickly follow a guy named Hasumichi, who is essentially working at a host club, even though that should be shut down here soon. He's working for it. And at some point, as he's walking home, the true army, this group that's, you know, controlling everything, they decide to wipe out an entire district that he's in because they discover that this, you know, rebel group is secretly working in that area. And so he's kind of caught it in the middle of a fight between the rebels and this true army. And the rebels is this one big shark robot thing, Garundal, that quickly runs out of energy and falls over. And so, kind of seeking safety, he decides to jump inside the cockpit of this thing and comes to find out that it's being powered by this girl. This girl's inside of it. It's this little chibi character that's in there. He has to use this little visor thing to control it. But his phone goes off, and it plays this theme song of this old anime, and it recharges this girl. This girl's able to recharge the machine, and it's able to fight again. So you quickly find out that, essentially, this rebel group is using these robots that essentially are powered by girls who have, like, passion in something. So this girl that he's working with right there has this passion for this old mecha anime. And so, again, she controls it, and they're able to fight, and they run off to their secret base, which, by the way, is in Akihabara, obviously, because that's where all the otaku stuff is. But anyways, yeah, he gets end up roped into working for this rebel group, and he basically works alongside these battery girls to fight against the true army that's trying to take away everything that, you know, entertains people. Old passions of video games and anime and idols and all that kind of stuff. Which leads you to the three main battery girls, which is Rin, who is into this mecha anime, Yuki, who is the last remaining idol, and Misa, who is this shut-in gamer girl. So that's pretty much the setup. And like I said, it A lot of the focus of this show, and I guess is really getting to the crux of my thoughts on the show. This show is really all about, I guess, passions versus patriotism. And this idea that this true army really is this group of people that seek to do everything they can in order to remove this stain that will harm the world, which is, you know, anime and video games, all these things that, you know, distract people from what they should be doing, which is, you know, keeping society going. And so the obvious struggle that you have there is that, again, that patriotism versus passion. This idea that Hosomichi's kind of in the middle, where you obviously realize that, you know, there's something there. He does have knowledge of this anime that Rin's talking about. He obviously has that cell phone ringtone. So he obviously has something there, but he's you kind of get a quick idea early on that he's kind of left that behind. He's quote-unquote grown up. And so he is struggling with the idea that now he has to work alongside these girls that he has to be kind of in sync with. He can't work with Rin if he's not, you know, going with the flow. Like, he has to act as if he's in this passion. That's his whole thing, is that he is good at putting on masks. So he is good at being whatever somebody wants him because he worked at a hostess bar. So he'll act like he is into this anime just to make Rin happy so they work together. But it doesn't work out in the end. He has to act like he's working with Yuki as his manager and supporting her as an idol, but he doesn't really care. And that becomes a thing as it goes along, is that struggle between, again, you know, these things that we love so much in this otaku nature, which I guess is really where I came into the show and was a little bit disappointed, is that it seems like this show is all about, you know, what we as otaku and fans of anime and other things, like, again, video games and stuff, all face at some point. We all face that aspect that society tells us that we need to grow up, we need to walk away from anime, we need to, why are you watching that anime stuff? You know, why are you playing video games? That scrutiny that we all face in the idea that society wants us to give up these things and be a cog. They want us to grow up and just be a bored adult. And there is still that feeling of that past, that thing that we leave behind that we want to go do because we enjoyed it, because it got us through our bad times, because we enjoy it. And I think it seemed like the show was about that. But while it is about that, it's not like it does anything with it. It's not as if it does anything really. It doesn't really do much with it interesting or creative besides just say that it's about that. And that's really where I struggle. I kept with the show, and I love the show early on because I really love the character designs. Again, Akio Watanabe makes really good-looking characters. And I love these characters. I think they're all fun. I love Rin. She's just a goofball, and she loves this old anime, and she's just fun and lovable. Yuki is technically the idol that, you know, is on stage and wants everybody to love her, and then she gets off the stage and says, oh, gosh, all right, get back to work and go get me a drink or something like that. She's got that little nasty side a little bit on the side. Misa, again, is more shutting character, but super hacker girl and just wants everybody to leave her alone so she can be huddled up in a room alone kind of thing, the neat aspect. They're fun, lovable characters, but it's not much feeling like it doesn't feel like it does much with the writing outside of that. Like, you have a good setup. You have a good concept, but the writing just isn't there to make it fun and interesting in some weird way. It just really feels like it's an empty shell with a really solid concept there that doesn't really do much with it. So that's kind of where I sit in the end, is I think it's a solid show if you just want to get into something that has that fight of, again, passion versus patriotism, and that concept of the cog versus your entertainment, that kind of thing is there. The old relics of the past of entertainment and otaku nature is there. They have, like, this whole segment where they're trying to essentially go into the underground area where you have, like, the deepest, darkest areas of otaku that they just kind of get into, which is a lot of fun. They call them basically relics, even though they're just stuff that we enjoy on a daily basis. Like, figure is a relic, basically. And that stuff was fun, but just it didn't. I just don't feel like the writing was really there. Like, the character writing, the storytelling itself just wasn't really there. And it was kind of, like I said, very unfortunate, because I think it had all the makings to be a really incredible, fun, fan service to all that love anything otaku. And again, just didn't pull it off. So, plus the later parts was really rough. Really rough later on. I was joking about the fact that they have this one segment where the battery girls basically reside in these capsules, and the capsules attach to the back of this robot, and the robot will change into something based on the girl. So they'll have, like, you know, Ren again is into this one mecha anime, so it turns into this Sharka mecha thing. And then they have, like, you know, the Yuki, it turns into more of like an idol bunny girl. And Misa turns into this cat girl, and it for some reason has an attachment that is basically a Kotatsu that just attaches to her back. But anyways, at some point, he's trying to go get the capsule because it's over here. And so it has this whole scene where he's being attacked by this one lady. And then suddenly out of nowhere, this truck comes flying off this cliff. Apparently it hit the lady off of him because we don't see that. And then it shows him with the capsule on his back, and it's just a still frame. It's not even moving. And then it goes, you got to go get the capsule. And then suddenly it shows him running without the capsule on his back. And then he picks up the capsule and attaches it. It's like, what are you? Oh my gosh, the animation just took a nosedive later on. So that was unfortunate too. But like I said, in the end, potential didn't live up to it, unfortunately. But if any of that sounds interesting to you, definitely check out Rumble Garindal. Kaganado is the next one. This one's streamed on Crunchyroll, Funimation, and High Dive. Ran for 12 episodes. They have a second season already announced for April 2022, which is fantastic. Studio is Leiden Films Kyoto Studios. The source is an original. The genres are comedy. And this one essentially opens up in a planetarium. It quickly jumps to Yume Mi, who is technically the planetarian of the visual novel Planetarian. As you quickly find out, this is a smash-up of all key studios' properties. So you have Clannad, Air TV, Little Busters, Rewrite, all kind of coming to one, and Canon, all coming into one world. And so it's kind of, you know, demonstrated by the idea of this planetarian and showing all these worlds kind of coming together. And so anybody that has known this Key Studios is a studio that does visual novels, and a lot of their visual novels have been adapted into animes, and so we're from a perspective of people that have watched the anime adaptation. And the whole concept, the whole spiel of this entire thing is to take all these characters and stick them into one place, kind of similar to Isekai Quartet, where it's just, for some reason, let's just throw all these characters into one school and have the shenanigans happen, and that's literally what happens. So first foremost, warning, if you have not watched all these shows or the visual novels, don't watch the show, because literally the first episode spoils every single one of the climaxes. Well, it doesn't really spoil the climaxes, it just kind of twists the climaxes in some way. But that's pretty much the jokes of this show, is basically taking all these characters and just throwing them at each other and making fun of everything about them. Again, their climaxes, their character archetypes. It groups up different archetypes to make fun of them. It talks about the fandom around the characters themselves and what they think of certain characters like Ryu. All for just fun. It almost feels like the writers just hold nothing back, because some of these characters they're super cruel with, like poor Mizusu. I would have to hear Goal one more time. I want to punch somebody. Your thoughts on Kaganado?
I was actually being truthful. I was a little afraid of going into this, not because I don't love the show or these characters. I absolutely adore these characters. I was actually a little bit afraid of going into it because I was scared that I wouldn't remember everything. Not so much because it's been a long time since I've watched a lot of these shows. So going into them, I was like, I'm afraid I'm going to miss the jokes, and I'm going to feel so bad if I don't find this hilarious, knowing that I should find it funny because I love these characters. And I was so pleasantly surprised that I didn't feel, while I knew I could see a joke, I could catch the reference, but it sometimes there was a like, I should know what the significance of that is. But for the most part, I generally caught on to the joke, and I just went along with it for the ride. So yeah, I had a blast watching this show. Every episode, I can't think of one episode that I didn't really have a blast watching. yeah, just too much fun. Highly suggested if you've watched the key shows. It's just it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think the only one that I really struggled with was the rewrite characters, and I think that's really a fault of the fact that Rewrite, the anime adaptation, was technically like a spin-off story. So it didn't really. I don't think the Rewrite anime really did well enough to explain the characters, and so when there was character aspects for Rewrite characters, I felt like I was a little lost. But other than that, like, all these characters are so iconic that it's really easy to remember. Oh yeah, I remember that about that character. Obviously, that's what they're gonna do. And so I think that kind of helps the fact that obviously for those that love Key, you love the characters. They just do a phenomenal job with characters, and they all have quirks that you just love and attach to. And so, yeah, when you see Kotomi appear with a violin, you know what's going to happen. When you see the mom from Kenon show up, you know she's got a jar of jam that she's going to have that people are going to be terrified of. And again, the whole aspect of how funny that is to really think of how bizarre they take that. The aspect that everybody's obsessed with Riki's, like, I guess that technically makes sense because that was the whole point of Little Busters, was that everybody loved Riki.
Well, it was hilarious
to see everybody fighting over here. Like, they want them to leave because she wants to make out with Riki.
In a lot of ways, they were roasting, like Andrew had mentioned, they were roasting the audience. They would roast the characters. They would roast even the author himself. It seemed like they were roasting him in a lot of cases. The weird obsession that this guy has with making at least one character with a thing of an obsession with something, and it kind of points it out with like the fish, the starfish, and then. What was the third one?
They had the little that was the takoyaki, the
fish was the takoyaki.
The other one was the character that was from Rewrite. That was the one that I couldn't really understand. It wasn't it the Shizuru?
Okay. Anyway, there was three at any rate. And
the surprising one was the one that they had, like, was it three or four characters were all the same Seiyu, and I was like, holy crap, I didn't know that. Yeah. It didn't dawn on me until they had this whole bit about it, and I'm like, oh yeah, that's true.
It was nice to hear my girl after a long time. She does not get any characters anymore, and so it was kind of nice to have her in Komori.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was nice to have her in a show after a long time of not hearing her.
Oh my gosh, Mizuzu and her encountering a certain somebody was like, "Oh crap, that's crazy. It didn't dawn on me that would be a thing that they would end up doing." I absolutely love that. There was so many good points. And like I said, the first episode was like so good. The pool episode was fantastic. I love, again, Riki, making fun of Riki as always. The protagonist meeting obviously had to happen. And that was priceless because, again, it's playing off of essentially them joking about everything kind of similar they do with each of them, but also kind of showing those differences that obviously some are more jealous of other ones for having better off. The sister meetings was great. There's so many good points in the show.
Absolutely loved the constant reminder to Sunohara at what place he belongs in the world.
They actually did something good with him. Like, they actually praised him at some point. I'm like, whoa, wait, so Sunohara is the winner right now? That's a shocker. It was good. I'm so happy for a second season because it's so good. I hope they have like just content to work with going forward, because there wasn't a single moment I wasn't either grinning from ear to ear or just laughing. It was that good. I absolutely loved it. So definitely looking forward to more of that. Moving on. Can I make your ears happy in 180 seconds? Right, 180 byo de kimi no mimi wo shirase ni dekiru ka? This one was streaming on pretty much YouTube. Nobody licensed it. Y'all suck. I was going to be shouting from the tallest mountains, go get a subscription here just to watch the show, but nobody wanted it. So, whatever. It was a 12-episode series that only had like 3 minutes and a half for each episode. Very short. Done by Ekachi Epilka Indivision. I don't know what those places are, but they made something. It's an original slice of life. But anyways, this one essentially is the concept of ASMR. For those that aren't familiar with ASMR, it's this concept of kind of inducing sounds, or kind of that really close nature in some cases of sounds and stuff in your ears that will eventually stimulate and cause an effect to your body, like a tingling in the back of your neck or whatever. And how typically people do that with a lot of channels and live streamers, they have microphones that will emulate the left ear and the right ear, and they'll record it in that way so that you can put on headphones and, again, experience almost that really closeness and intimacy that will trigger that reaction. And so the girl of this show, well, girls of this show, end up buying these dummy heads that have these microphones on each ear, and they do things to stimulate that effect. And the first girl's kind of doing it just to get the attention of a boy. Second girl's doing it because she read some weird book that said if you get an ASMR, you'll get friends. I don't know, maybe she just watched her live stream and said, oh, I can get friends this way. And then later on, it gets into the hands of a mother and a sister, and eventually the boy that the first girl, I think, was trying to get with, I think his two sisters got a hold of one because one of them's into the brother. And then eventually, I think it was Shusui, the one that wanted friends. I think she ends up going to meet this host guy that ends up doing some stuff with that too. Yeah. It's weird. And that's exactly why I wanted to check it out. I thought it would be a really fun concept and very interesting concept. I love things like One Room where they experiment with storytelling and do something different that's sometimes very weird and sometimes creepy to some people. But I love it because it's different and it's weird. But yeah, I was definitely let down on the show. I was not happy with the show. I did watch it with earphones just so that I can get the full experience of it. And I think in so many ways, they didn't execute on it very well. For one aspect, I feel like anything besides certain sound effects and direct speaking into ears wasn't utilizing the stereo microphones properly. So it felt like in often cases, even though the characters were talking in different areas, the stereo effect wasn't happening. And I felt like that was a missed opportunity because it didn't really feel like a full ASMR experience, I guess. If you're going to do ASMR, you would probably want to record the entire thing with the dummy mic, and it feels like it was only like half of the recording session was done that way. And so that was a huge letdown. The other huge letdown is, and it's not really the fault of the show or the creators, is obviously a big thing in Japan is ear cleaning. And so 99% of the stuff that they did was ear cleaning, so it was kind of just nothing but crunching noises in one ear or the other. So it was kind of like, okay, cool. I bet that's really cool in Japan. I don't like it. I don't get it. And I just don't think the outside of that, they didn't really do anything storytelling wise to really kind of spice it up. Besides the sisters, they had some really goofy thing where one sister was like super yandere for the brother. And so she was talking about like using this toxin to kill and stop a relationship from happening. So it was kind of like, whoa, okay, we're doing that.
Wait, what
was kind of fun. That was kind of fun. Yeah. She's talking about like some lizard that has like some weird toxin, and she's like, do you know what that toxin is? I'll use that. It was great. I loved it.
I have to go and watch this show just because of this.
I think it's like episode 9. It's the only episode they're in too. That's what's frustrating. It's like, that was really great. Where are they at now?
This was the most random thing that came out of this show. I'm like, wait, ASMR, wait, yonder, what? Wait, whoa, yonder. Whoa, wait, what?
She's like, what will happen if our brother gets married? And she's like, do you know what this toxin is? It's from this one lizard. And if you use that toxin, and you know, she's like going into like, do you know how many people disappear in a year in Japan? And it's like, oh my gosh, dude, what the hell is this girl talking about? I was like half expecting her to like talk about like, you know, the disintegration factor of using bleach on bodies or something like that, and like getting some crazy like psycho killer kits or something like that. I don't know.
You've just made this one particular episode.
That one episode.
It's the only good episode. Watch count just flew up.
Besides that episode, which I think was like the only really good episode, I did like the first episode that Hikari was in. I thought that was, again, one of the more interesting uses of the ASMR recording, and they utilizing a lot of like, you know, ice into a jar or ice into a cup and stirring and all that kind of stuff. It was an interesting use of it, I guess. Everything outside of that's usually kind of they get into baby role play. I'm not into that at all. So that one was a weird episode. Baby role play is not. There was actually two episodes of baby role play, and I'm like, no. I guess I should have expected it because you have the mama character come into the picture. Obviously, they're going to do baby role play. I don't do that. The Ichia's episode was all right. Jiro, which was the voice of the guy that does Ichia.
from Fairy Tail. He did a solid voice. It was, again, more akin to the guy from A Sense of a Bookworm, his role there. He's got a very kind of mature and interesting voice. Not Kendro Suda, but still solid. I don't know. It is one of those ones where I think you can check it out for certain reasons. Again, it's very obviously suggestive in a lot of cases. A lot of the cases when the girls blow into the ear, the microphone is, or the camera is from the perspective of the inside the ear. So it's obviously implying some certain hole that people like to put things in. It's obviously going for innuendos and erotic stuff. And that's typically what ASMR is. So let's not joke there. A lot of lotion squishing and that kind of stuff, which is obviously implying things. A lot of heavy breathing. So I don't know. It was a letdown in the end. I think it's going to be still a fun thing if you're really big fans of certain seiyus. You might like a lot of these characters too. Like I mentioned before, the seiyu that did Kaguya from Kaguya's Love is War is technically in the show that you should probably check out if you're a super fan of hers. I know there's a lot of fans of her out there, but it was a letdown in the end. I think there was a lot of opportunities to do some interesting stuff, and they just didn't really utilize a lot of that stuff well enough. So I was disappointed. But still weird, still fun in that regard. So, can I make your ears happy in 180 seconds? Check it out if that's interesting to you. Moving on to our last one, we have 86, the second season. Again, it's only ran for 10 episodes because the last two episodes were so far delayed, they decided to delay it into oblivion. But even still, I thought it'd be good to get on here and kind of give our brief thoughts. It is kind of a difficult one to talk about just because this is technically the second season and quite a bit happens at the end of the first season. But for those that are unfamiliar with 86, this essentially is a series that takes place in a world where the most of the focus in the first season really centers around Sag Magnolia, which is this empire that is pretty much sometime in its history was dealing with this thing called the Legion, which were these unmanned machines that were just wiping them out. And at some point, in order to protect itself, it decided to basically segregate itself off in a way so that 85 districts of this place is of people of Alba blood, which is a certain race. And anybody that's not Alba gets sent to the 86th district, where they essentially have to protect the 85. And they are thankless in that regard, because essentially everybody within the 85 districts believes that the war is being handled by unmanned machines. But the military themselves know that it's being controlled or they're being protected by the people of the 86. They're being sent out there. They're treated like, you know, lesser than human. They're treated like pigs. They're sent out to the war thanklessly to basically fight off the Legion that's threatening the 85. And this mostly focuses on, the story mostly focuses on Lena, who is an Alba that is working as a handler. And these handlers basically direct the 86 to go out into battle. And Lena is, unlike most everybody else, actually does care for the people of the 86. She finds it unjust that they fight for them. But still, she's kind of in her ivory tower, basically talking about how she's upset about it. Well, on the other side, you get a lot of perspective of the 86, mostly focusing around Shin, who is leading this one group of the 86 as they go out to battle against the Legion. Over time, learning about things such as what the Legion are, how the Legions basically harvest the minds of people that fall on the battlefield, all that kind of stuff. The second season, the second part, I guess the best way to get into it without spoiling things too much is it really does expand the world, I think. And it was, technically, it's in my thoughts on the season overall, is I really do feel like the second season does really well in expanding the world more than I thought it would. The biggest fear that I had coming into the second season was obviously a lot of people talking about how the first season adapted the first volume of 86, and that the writer had no plans to go past the first volume, and so thus anything past the first volume and in onward, which would be the second season, is not good. And so I did have fears getting in the second season, like, whoa, crap, now everybody's saying that this, you know, beyond the first volume sucks, so the second season is obviously going to suck. Don't agree at all. Now that I'm getting into the second season, I think it's doing great stuff. I love it so much. I don't feel like things have shifted. I feel like it's still great writing as it ever has been. And I really love the direction it's taking it, because it's kind of expanded the world a lot. It's really pushed out the borders a lot, showing us a lot of things that's going on outside of the Sand Magnolia, which I really do appreciate.
The stuff that they're doing with a lot of the surrounding nations is really fantastic. Really love the stuff they're getting into there. And I think a lot of the conflict that's happening is as good as it's ever been. I think my only struggle that I've had so far is that with essentially two different stories being told, two very separated stories, a frustration that I get a lot as I'm watching this series is that sometimes I feel like I'm not getting enough of this side when this side is being told. I always have this conflict that when I'm spending too much time on this side, I want to know more about this side. And so I guess it's a sign of how much I care about the characters that I get so frustrated with the fact that I don't get enough of one or the other. And I think that's not a negative thing, but at the same time, it is a struggle. Visually, it's still keeping up to par. A lot of the combat sequences are fantastic. Really love a lot of the character development so far. I think the only thing that I'm really struggling with is, how do I say this again? I guess at this point, I probably should just say soft spoilers for the second season, because I don't know how I can get into this stuff without really mentioning things. So if you have not watched the first season, you're struggling with not wanting to know about what happens at the season finale of the first season, which is definitely a big, huge turning point, I guess you'll have to stop listening at this point. But no, anyways, with that said, I'm struggling with Shin. I really think that the story... I think they spent like another good two episodes really trying to dig at him. And at this point, I'm getting frustrated with his writing. Because I think we spent way too much time so far really kind of playing him off as being the battle-hungry character. Goes berserk a lot. And they're trying to do something with his character. And I understand what they're doing with the character, but at the same time, I'm getting tired of it. Like, I really do hope...
He hasn't grown.
He's stuck. Yeah. And I wouldn't mind him being stuck if it weren't for the fact that it's too much stupid focus on it. So anyways, that was my frustration. I guess now that we're kind of in soft spoilers, I really love Frederica. I really wasn't sure what I was going to think of when they added her to the story, but I think she's a really good addition to the story that obviously Tom of Seiyu, I fell in love with really immediately. I mocked the fact that they added her to the story, and I love the writer constantly keeps reminding me that, oh, by the way, I know what I'm doing. And I go, oh, okay, so you're going to explain that. Okay, so you know what you're doing.
Between her and Lena, they're about the only two characters that have driven me through this show. Really have. I have not much cared. 86.
You don't like Kurina? You don't like Kurina? You don't like Greth? Greth was fantastic.
Seeing as how so I don't really remember who... Oh, the girls
Greth
in the 86.
Greth is Rintasaka. Greth is Rintasaka.
They're all right. They didn't really... I'm at this stuck point of I don't allow myself to much care for a lot of those characters. And they could hurt me with Lena and Frederica just as easy. So it's not like I'm not aware of how much care this writer has for his characters. It's more along the lines of I don't trust him with the 86. I really don't. And the last episode pretty much proved me right on doing that. So and you know, you don't see a death on the screen.
I want to tell everybody right now, this is why I didn't want Chris to watch this show, because his only point is I don't like the fact that this character might die. And if they make this character die, I'm not going to enjoy the show. That's my thoughts on the show. It's like his whole focus point is solely on will characters die or not. It's like this. I don't think the show is that anymore.
No, and you know it's funny is there is some cool things in this show.
There is so many good things in this show. Like Ernst was phenomenal. I was so surprised by Ernst. Like I wanted Ernst to be a bad guy, and they did so many good. There's so many good points in the show with Ernst. Like, when he said that he literally leveled the world, I was like, this is such a good character. Again, Greth was a fantastic character. Her respect for the people. Again, getting into the whole idea of them being welcomed into another nation, and that other nation, you wondering if they're going to treat them like the Sanguine Magnolia did. Is this a comfortable nation for them to be in? And obviously, the parallels the two nations will end up having in the end, I thought was phenomenal. There's so many good points in the show. The moment they said they were going to send the 86 off, and all this perspective of Shin and the past, and the 86 calling out to him from the grave, basically saying, they're just like the second Magnolia. I loved it. There's like so many good points in this show. It's, I cannot, I, every week watching this show, there was something to really dig into because it, again, this writer is so good at characters and so good in not just nation conflicts, but just kind of the hypocrisies of different nations and different, and the leadership itself. I think they do such a good job with that stuff. And again, yes, technically there are a lot of conflicts in how to deal with the legions and lots of people. And yes, Kitty and the parallels that Frederica draws between Kitty and Shin, as much as I'm getting frustrated with Shin. I think Shin's really my only weakness that I have this show right now. I love all the characters outside of that. I do wish they would do more with a lot of the other 86 characters with Shin, because they spend so much time on him. It's like, I feel like the other characters just, there's so much they can do with them. They don't do anything because they're so focused on Shin and the Nozin tribe or clan or whatever. I don't know. And that was my frustration with Lina. I think Lina is a phenomenal character, and I feel like we've just barely got into her, like, stepping up and being, like, badass. Like the moment she showed back up and she's got, like, this, you know, one part of her hair is, like, dyed. I don't know if it's, like, dyed red because the whole parade system messed her up somehow, or if it's just her dyeing it for a reason. She's using a different colored cloak just to kind of give a big finger to the entire group. And she's stepping up and taking over charge of everything. I'm like, this girl's, like, doing stuff. Like, she's not even, like, they're saying, you know, you can't use this artillery and stuff. She's like, whatever, I'm going to do it anyways. It's just like they've shown how much stronger she's become, and not in a cheesy way. That's what I love about it. She's stepping up in a mature way. And yet, again, we haven't seen anything of her. I'm hoping we do eventually, soon, like next episode, please, because she's in a bad spot. It sucks. Sorry. Any other thoughts?
Yeah, I liked it.
And you're going to shut up because I made fun of you. Yeah, Frederica's good too. I really love Frederica's introduction. I loved, like, again, I mocked the fact that she's technically, obviously, again, it wasn't much of a shocker when we found out that she's tied in with some of the royalty. It didn't make sense that she exists. You would think that she'd be killed immediately. It explains that. Why is she on the battlefield? Explains that. And again, it's like the writer going, I know what I'm doing. I got this handled.
Yeah, I like the Goddess of Victory. I like the basically reverse. To me, it was the two countries basically were reverse mirrors of each other. So you had the one who treated 86 as kind of a tool, but it was a tool that they didn't want. And in the Federation, was that the Federation is the other group where they treated 86 as a tool that they actually didn't want to use. So yeah.
The Gyad Federacy. Yeah. Good stuff. Great characters. Great storytelling as always. Fantastic animation. Which makes me okay with the fact they've delayed so much. I don't want them to botch the show, but at the same time, it is honestly frustrating that it's taken so long to get the rest of this show. I hope it has a really solid conclusion. But yeah, good stuff. Really enjoy it. We'll see how it concludes the last two episodes in 3 months when the next season starts. But yeah, that's it. That's all of the fall. We're ready to move on. I like I said before, we'll have probably deliberations next week, and then we can get started in the new season. It's gonna be excited. But we hope you guys enjoyed our reviews of the fall 2021 anime season. And all of our reviews of the year 2021. Hope you guys enjoyed the year 2021 and our coverage of it. Hope you guys stick with us as we go into 2022 and get started with there. So, as always, definitely appreciate everybody that supports us through Patreon or through our tips link on our main website or through our other links. If you're on YouTube, through our description links there. I definitely appreciate everybody that supports us through there. We appreciate you guys supporting us vocally as well. It's also good as well. Telling other people about us is another way that you can support us. Hitting the like buttons, subscribing to us in other locations, all that kind of stuff is always definitely appreciated as well. We hope you guys enjoyed, and y'all take care.
Os. Monday,
な時も私のそば